It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! And here we go, off and running for this 27th day of December 2018. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you will find us. That, of course, is where you go if you'd like to click on chat room and pop in and pick out a screen name and a password and join in the merry, madcap, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that takes place during the 3 hours in which this program is live Monday through Friday from 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Yeah, come on in. The conversation is fine. If you do jump in, you'll be immediately greeted by the likes of Anatole and Little Thunder and Otto DeShot and Squeaky and Will in Chicago and, of course, capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, though a spacing guild master and absolutely full of fabulous roasted turkey, has folded space to become Man Cave. Also present for the moderating this evening is pinch hit midweek utility chat room moderator and all around great guy, Steve from Georgistan. It's a happy time that we have in there. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is Thorn in the Side Thursday, the final Thorn in the Side Thursday of 2018. 2018 is truly on its last legs. Our last broadcast of 2018 will take place tomorrow evening. And then, I don't know. We're still up in the air as far as the schedule is concerned for New Year's Eve. I'm yet harboring some hope to maybe take Agnes out and for a little evening, you know, gussied up and seeing the old year out and the new year in, that sort of thing. Don't know if that's going to happen, though. But if it happens, we won't be here. If it doesn't happen, we will be here. I'll be here. I hope you'll be here. But we got at least two more programs tonight and tomorrow in which to be done with 2018. We also have thanks to extend for this 27th day of the month. Thanks to our subscribers. Thanks going out this evening to Julie. Thank you, Julie. And thank you to Susan. And thank you to our buddy Robert in Australia. Thank you, all three of you, for being partial sponsors of the program and helping to make a week of fundraising-free radio possible. Thank you very, very kindly to Susan and Julie and Robert and all the other Horn subscribers, both at Patreon and via PayPal, for taking care of about a week's worth of every month's funding and keeping this little independent, liberal, progressive broadcast operation rolling. Thank you most sincerely. Let's see. It being Thorn in the Side Thursday, well, we have plenty of we have plenty of stuff that makes us, you know, make that noise to go into this evening. Oh, we've got an abundance of white wing stupid with which to deal. Because, well, this could be a 15-hour program and we would still not run out of white wing stupid to account and talk about, because there's such a gosh darn surfeit of it. But also this evening, I thought we would take time early in the evening to check in with my old friend and now your friend, Dan Fisher, from up New York way, as he continues in his recovery from heart transplant surgery, and talk a little bit of 2018 retrospective film and TV biz, what's good, what's hot, what's not, what the coming and changing trends are. And, well, I think it'll, every time, and hey, there's Terry in Saigon joining the chat room. Hey, Terry, how are you? Welcome aboard from, all the way from Ho Chi Minh City. Glad you could join us. But anyway, we'll deal with the we'll deal with the thorns in the side after a little conversation to check in and see how what Dan's up to and how he's doing. By the way, in terms of the holiday calendar, Randy in PA reminds us, in Russia, Orthodox Christmas is on January 7th, 2019, and takes place after their New Year's celebration. This is because of the 13-day difference between the Gregorian and Julian calendar systems. Yes, and it's one of those things over which Christians have slaughtered each other over the course of the last, 1,000, 1,100, 1,200 years or so. Die, heretic! Right. Mm-hmm. So, that's, oh dear. Further proof, I guess, of the war on Christmas. Speaking of the war on Christmas, on the way home today, Ferg and I were out and about, and we were driving down the lanes that lead through the back roads of the hills and hollers back here to the magnificent Kincaid Mansion and the fabulous Horn Studios. When Ferg said, "Dad, look, the war on Christmas has come to us." And yes, yes, there they were. A whole bunch of Christmas decorations, the inflatable types, all laid over in the grass, and I thought, we should have gotten a picture of that, and maybe we will, like, tomorrow or something. But it's not often that you see the immediate aftermaths of the battlefields of the war on Christmas. Yes. Yes, the war on Christmas is a heartrending, terrifying thing. I think the award for best Christmas yard decorations go to the woman in Louisiana who used big inflatable dragons for her Christmas yard decorations until her neighbors complained that they were demon possessed, and so she responded by putting Santa hats on each and every little dragon. Christmas dragons. Yeah, how about that? So let's go ahead and run over to the line where Dan Fisher is waiting to join us. Happy holiday season, Dan. I hope things are going swimmingly for you.
Well, I'm not swimming yet. I can swim, actually. I just haven't gone to the pool yet.
It's a mite cold even up there. A mite, as you recall, we say here in the hills. A mite.
Well, we say a mite, too. You know, we say a skosh up here in Fancy Pants, New York. But yes, it has been a swimmingly very lovely holiday season, Christmas, and looking forward to New Year's and the new year. And I hope the same for you and your family.
Well, thank you. Thank you very kindly. If it weren't for the fact that it would probably give your cardiologist the fantods, I would say, gosh, come on down New Year's Day. The corned beef will be on the smoker alongside the cabbage, and we'll have turnip greens and cornbread, and your cardiologist would, yes, have the fantods.
Yes, she would. She would wrap her very, very strong, well-educated hands around my throat and give me a nice strangle if I tried to indulge myself in some of the stuff. You post those lovely pictures of, a hog's head or a lamb shank or whatever you do on your grill,
and possum knuckle. Yes.
Yeah, and I'm the only non-vegetarian, semi-vegan or what have you in our household, as well as being the only non-Jew. So I've alienated myself even further by occasionally indulging in the flesh of formerly living creatures. But yes, it's been great, and I also just wanted to wish a happy new year to, I don't know what you call your listeners, like horn hats or hornets.
We have variously been known as hornies and hornedonistas, and so all of that is appropriate and applicable and whatever you choose.
Well, I wish really truly only the best upcoming new year, and of course a great life to all of you. I'm going to call you I like horn hats for some reason. It makes me think of Hagar the Horrible or something. But I wish just
horn,
a great
horn call. Heads, horn heads,
hornets. But I thank you guys so much for letting me be on the show. I thank you, Bob, for always indulging me and letting me trespass upon your hallowed ground. And for the listeners who don't turn it off as soon as I start talking.
Well, this is West Virginia. The ground is not so much hallowed as it is hollowed. That's called mind subsidence. But
the hollers, yes.
We're tickled pink to have you along, and you sound a little stronger with every conversation that we have. I trust things are going well for you. The last time we talked, you'd been out and voted, and So were you able to go out and see some holiday decorations or anything like that this time through?
Yeah, I was listening to your show. We don't have dragons in our – we're very low-key here in our household anyway when it comes to this stuff. My neighbors have, the giant, Herbie the dentist and things like that. And, everything is inflatable now, which is fun actually, but it's also a bit silly. There was a large inflatable pig with a Santa hat, and I was trying to come up with the significance of that, and I don't know of any songs or stories of like the Happy Christmas Pig. If anybody does know, they're welcome to.
It sounds to me like that's fertile ground, and it may be Horace the Happy Christmas Pig. It could be a modern carol for the ages. I'm trying to think. I think it was you. I'm pretty sure it was you as we geezerly walk down memory lane, who one Christmas far, far long ago sat, and I remember an evening where you repeatedly, well, not yelled at the top of your lungs, but said loudly enough for everybody at all the other tables to hear you, repeated that iconic line from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, "Nobody wants a Charlie in the box."
That's right. Nobody wants a Charlie in the box. It's Santa. Yeah, that's one of the few celebrity impressions I can do, the Island of Misfit Toys.
And you do it so well, very well.
I thank you, but we didn't watch that this year. We did watch, we watched four Christmas-related entertainment things. We watched Santa Claus is Coming to Town, we watched Charlie Brown, we watched the Festivus episode of Seinfeld, and just last night, Helene and Gus and I watched Die Hard. So that's we got our four sort of different perspectives of Christmas. We still have the Christmas Story DVD and the Rudolph DVD sitting out on the shelf. And, you could still watch them. I used to watch that stuff in the middle of July, thanks to the miracle that used to be VHS tape.
Well, but, I'm on a little mini campaign, Dan, to get The Lion in Winter included as a Christmas classic.
Yeah, I love the movie, but what makes it Christmas?
Because it's set at fucking Christmas.
Is it? I've watched it maybe twice. It's fantastic, and Peter O'Toole Catherine Hepburn.
I mean, there's even a line where young Johnny says, "Oh, I love Christmas."
Hmm. Okay.
And, yeah. The entire plot unfolds from a declaration by Henry that there will be a Christmas court at Chinon.
See, now you're just showing off that majestic voice of yours that always got you cast in plays because it was nice and deep, and you could put on an affected accent with anybody.
Well, thank you.
These days I'm going to go a little too far in these little elbows to the ribs, and I'm going to just hear the equivalent of a dial tone.
No, because I had to confront reality in my acting career a long, 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 long time ago in a little place called Tuscaloosa, and after that, you know, just got comfortable with it. But yeah, it is fun throwing out those, because there's so, in The Lion in Winter, there's so many wonderful, wonderful lines. You know, Katharine Hepburn looking at her sons and saying, "It's the 11th century. We're all barbarians. Of course we all carry knives."
Yeah, where do you think Game of Thrones, you know, I'm sure when the creators of Game of Thrones were getting everything together, they had to watch that movie. Because one of the great things about Game of Thrones, it isn't just about the nudity and the CGI dragons. There's a lot of wonderful little quips on that show.
Without a doubt. It's just my problem with the Game of Thrones is I can't find anybody that I don't want the dragons to just eat and put us all out of our misery.
Mm.
I mean, maybe there's like one decent human being in the whole, what, Jon Snow, maybe? But by the way, you have earned yourself, early in this conversation, Dan, you've earned yourself a question from Darlene in Connecticut, who wants to know, please ask Dan what he thinks is wrong with the doll in the Land of the Misfit Toys.
She just is neurotic. She has very low self-esteem. And this was, you know, this came out in like the mid to late 60s, this show. So they didn't really, you know, they didn't put a lot of focus on raising, you know, young girls' self-esteem. And that's something we definitely, you know now that we need to do is, you know, give girls a little credit. I mean, you know, none of the female characters in Rudolph have a whole lot to do. It's all about the boys and supporting the boys. And I love that show, and I'm not going to create any controversy about it. But it's not the most woke thing in the world. I mean, you know, Santa is a bit of a jerk. he only, you know, it's not until he needs Rudolph that he treats him like, you know, somebody, you know, deserving of consideration and courtesy. Other than that, he's like, "Oh, it's too bad. He had a nice takeoff too." He always has a nice takeoff, even with the red nose. You could have used a guy with a good takeoff. Did it really matter that he was, you know, blinking red? But before we go too Christmassy and stuff, there's two things. You know, I like to speak parenthetically, as you know. I think one of the main reasons I was trying to beg to get on this show earlier than later is because, you know, as we all know, the new year is coming up. So I thought that in addition to hashing over Christmas, as if we weren't all tired of it, we could hash over maybe a bit of 2018 in general, you know, the old year in review thing, as if your listeners haven't had enough of that. But I also thought then one of the best ways to do it, especially since a lot of the issues that have really come up this year have been issues involving women, like Me Too and the Kavanaugh hearings. And therefore, I begged your indulgence, and you granted it, and I think you're going to be very happy you did so. To bring on a special guest, and my special guest tonight is with me right now on the couch.
Oh, yay!
It is my daughter Phoebe Fisher.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, Phoebe. Pleasure to meet you.
You too.
I thought that, you know, it would be nice to have somebody under the age of 50 speaking with us, and of course, you know, a woman's perspective on all kinds of things, whether it's the news or whether it's, hey, what movie did you like recently? It would just be good to kind of just throw some monkeys into the some monkeys into the wrenches. That makes
you,
no sense.
West Virginia people astound me with your language.
You wait. You West Virginia people. Well, you know, we little Missy, we were toddling along in the old, we had old Dobbin hooked up to the shay, and we were Going through the 3 feet at 3 feet of snow uphill both ways, coming home one day. No, I'm not going to do that. But yes, we are known for our picaresque speech, Phoebe.
Good.
Well, you know,
I guess that was good.
I used to tell my kids and my the woman who would eventually become my wife, I would tell them these things about growing up in West Virginia. And this was certainly the case with Helene, and I think with my kids too, that when I finally brought them back to the hometown to look around, they were shocked because the way I depicted it, they were expecting shacks and, you know, a railroad running through the middle of town and stuff. And they're like, these are just nice middle class homes you have here. And, you know, people are wearing shoes and, you know, some of them can say more than two syllables at a time. I kind of played up my hillbilly roots a little overly much. So,
Phoebe, let me just tell you, he didn't take you to the fun parts of West Virginia. They exist. I know where that town with the railroad tracks in the middle of it is. Mm. But not only for your youthful perspective, but also for the fact that you spend a considerable amount of time outside the territorial confines of the United States. So I think you can bring an international perspective to the conversation this evening as well, Phoebe. So I welcome that. You're a university student. What year in far Canada?
I'm a first year at McGill University, so that's in Montreal, Quebec. So yeah, it's like I wouldn't consider myself offering much of an international perspective, but I do spend a lot of time with Canadians, and like McGill is a very international school, so it is like kind of the first time I've been in an academic environment with a lot of people like coming from entirely different places of the world.
And do they spend much time? I simply have to ask because if your dad hasn't told you yet, we spend a lot of time with politics here, yeah, and culture, and I just as you're walking around the hallowed halls and whatnot, do you hear a lot of? Is the current madness that infects our nation here much on the minds of folks there?
I mean, it depends who you ask. People definitely talk a lot about politics at the university because it's a major university. I mean, if you're talking to the poli sci majors, that's all they talk about, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, though, because I was obviously in Montreal for both the Quebec elections and our midterm elections. So I actually got a little bit of the taste of how I think Americans always look at Canada as like, at least like I didn't learn anything about Canadian politics in school or even just like, you know, we just don't talk about it that much. So it was interesting to kind of see that like not all Canadians are these like, you know, smooth agreeing people. Like they do have their own like political conflicts, granted not comparable to our discussion in climate right now. But it was interesting to hear their discussions. But it also it was interesting when like the midterms are going on and the Kavanaugh trials, everything was just happening where to a certain extent, yes, like my Canadian friends and other like students are absolutely aware of like big things going on in the US. But it definitely wasn't like talked about in the way that like, if I was at a United States university, it would be like the topic of conversation that day.
I mean, this is all I know of the Canadian political culture is that they have, you know, Trudeau as their premier, and that he seems really cool and he's kind of hot. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. I know what a, you know, charismatic, you know, good looking young, you know, relatively young man is. And he's that. And so, you know, the thing is, too, is that we tend to compare now because we're in the Trump era. I hate to call it that, you know. I think we tend to idealize anybody who's not Trump, and I think, you know, a lot of my friends are like, God, I wish Trudeau were the president of our country, and you know, compared to Trump, you wish almost anybody is. But you know, it's interesting to have heard from Gus, and I don't know your thoughts, yeah, Phoebe, but he's not quite as beloved and perfect,
no,
as we seem to look at it down here, because we don't know anything. We get very little news, mm-hmm, from Canada or anything outside of the United States.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of like issues with Trudeau and a lot of discussions that I've heard from other Canadian people that I'm like getting more educated about, because again, like I realized when I went to Canada how like little we talk about and know about generally about Canadian politics and history. But Trudeau definitely has issues on how he deals with Indigenous rights, and he gets a lot of credit for taking in Rohingya refugees, but he really only took in a few thousand. Like, he turned away a lot more than he took in. And there's a lot of other issues of cultural appropriation. Like, not that you can any way compare him to Trump or other world leaders that I think are way more problematic, but he's not this perfect icon. And I think it's dangerous to look at any individual, especially a political individual, as perfect. Especially, I think, the fact that he's, like, an attractive, relatively young white man, it's really easy to kind of feed into that image.
And of course, there's climate change, Phoebe, and you present a rare opportunity for me in this program and in the milieu in which I work. Hillbillies use words like milieu sometimes, but for a young person, to what degree? Because this is one of those issues where Trudeau has been pretty roundly criticized because he continues to carry water for the pipeline industry and the various, well, you know, the moonscape in northern Alberta, you know, the tar sands. But a lot of the things that I read suggest that, and it's heartening to me, that climate change is on your generation's radar in a big way. Can you confirm or deny that, please?
Yeah, definitely. I think that honestly, like, it's not really in human nature to think of climate change as a super immediate issue the way that something like, you know, a social, like, human to human issue would be, but it absolutely is, like, on our minds. Like, I think I share the experience of a lot of other, not all, but a lot of other young people, that, like, I feel much more uncomfortable throwing out something that, like, paper that can be recycled than someone who is older, just because I'm so not used to that. But I mean, that's kind of more everyday routine things that's just like the way I grew up or have experienced most of my life. And that is just like considered one of the major political issues to me and mine. But I mean, again, I can only really talk for myself and my friends and people
well,
I know.
You know, I have a lot of hope and a lot of faith in the millennial generation. You know, a lot of, you know, I'm now getting of the age, and I'm sure you see it too, Bob, where, you know, it's very easy for people of our generation to find fault with the millennials. You know, all they do is stare at their phones. All they want to do is take selfies, and, you know, and the music isn't as good as the good old days of Dylan and the Beatles, etc.
Get off my lawn.
Off my lawn. You know, everybody is always going to do, you know, Phoebe will someday, 30 years down the line or so, be criticizing, you know, her children's, assuming she might ever have children, she'll be criticizing that the same way. It's just a thing we all do.
I don't know. Yeah. Oh, 40 years from now, Phoebe, you'll probably be wandering around saying, I don't know what it is with you young people. You got to have these plugs in your neck.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll see. I don't know. I like to think that I'm an open-minded middle-aged person. I don't know.
Well, getting used to, though.
And your dad's an open-minded middle-aged person, and so am I. I mean, we're having a certain amount of fun here. I joke about my geezerdom, but I think your dad is right, Phoebe, because it is each generation's almost obligation to challenge the standards and mores of the prior generation.
Absolutely.
Late 19th century parents of my parents were absolutely disgusted by that big band swingy music.
And you know, and as open-minded as I would love to lay credit for, I mean, the fact is that it still takes time. It's never easy to change, no matter how easy, how open-minded you think you are. You know, I'll sometimes be faced with, you know, like, for example, I've learned a lot about the gender identification issues, LGBTQ issues, from both my children, from Gus and Phoebe. And some of it, you know, has taken time to adjust to, and some things I still just kind of push back on. The thing of people choosing to call themselves a they or a them instead of a he or a she. I mean, that's their, you know, that's their choosing their identification. I know that, and it's, and the idea of me being not that, saying, well, no, you can't do that because it defies the laws of what I learned in English class. But it's still not something that I can really get used to. I still call people either he or she. And I don't mean that to be disrespectful. It's just my brain has been pushed in that direction for so long. It seems to me something that I can't quite just necessarily reverse course on overnight. And I'm not even sure if I should or need to. Will this be a phase or no. You know, I don't know. You know, language continually evolves.
Well, I would say that, I mean, any, like, that's understandable, any language pattern, like, it's inherent that it is, like, anything, any kind of thing we say is inherent. Like, it's really difficult to change language patterns. I will say that, like, the amount, because I have a lot of, like, gender nonconforming or gender queer friends, I've had gender queer partners, and it's about, I think it's about a matter of respect, and it's about the amount of effort you put in. Like, at least I can't talk for the trans community at all, but some of my trans friends have, when they've educated me, because they're very gracious, have explained this. It's not like, oh, if you mess it up once, you know, you're this horrible person. It's a matter of respect that if they're saying that this is a part of who they are and how they feel comfortable with themselves and what makes them feel happy and safe, and that you doing something really simple, like changing one word in your phrasing, or at least putting an effort in, means that you are showing them respect and that you are trying to, like, being kind to them and respect their feelings and who they are, then it's absolutely worth it putting that effort in.
And I find, Dan, I find it, and Phoebe, I find it interesting that you immediately went to that, the pronoun issue, because we're talking here about pronouns if we're going to be language nerds, and uh-huh. And I are one. But, you know, it's difficult to separate, I would say that the community, for instance, that we're engaging with right now, there's not anybody out there who wants to see discrimination or wants to treat anyone as anything other than a human being, which is, at the end of the day, what we all are. But when you raise that pronoun issue, for people like you and me, because that's immediately where my mind went as well, those are issues that are separate and apart. Language stands separate and apart from identity, I guess, is one way of putting it. And I think about, for instance, the structure of, and we go back to your work on the Americans, for instance, and our mutual friend, gone but not forgotten, who is a Russian language specialist, who once, you know, pointed out to me that in formal Russian culture, when you refer to a person and you're referring to them in the third person, you don't say he or she, you use their daggum name.
Right.
Alexander Mikhailovich, not he.
Yeah, it's when, you know, we did Chekhov at WVU in theater. And, you know, sure enough, you have to get used to when you say the lines. You know, it's like, you know, yeah, Alexander Mikhailovich, over and over, you have to say full names of the people. And the same when you read Turgenev or any of the Russian writers, it's you're right. That is true. And maybe that is the most respectful way. And you know, it's, I think I'll get there, you know, and what Phoebe says is very relevant. I don't know if, like, when I'm writing, I'm going to, you know, ever get away from using what I, you know, he's and she's. But in terms of especially dealing specifically with specific people, if Phoebe were to bring home a person that identifies or wishes to be identified in a certain way, I would like to think that at least consciously I would be very respectful of that. And I don't want to, you know, I want to be open to that.
No, I get what you're saying, because, you know, we try to be decent people. Oddly enough, as when I was being raised by my World War II Depression era parents, there was my father, when he was coming home from the Navy, and, you know, this is 1945, he spent some time with a family in Washington State, and they had a phrase in their little family unit. One did not refer to someone that one cared about, especially a woman, especially one's mother, with an impersonal pronoun. And the way they reminded each other of it, and this was carried back to the hills and hollers of almost level West by Cold Trump Jr. Stan.
Well, sorry for interrupting. Is there a sentence you could give in this example, or are you leading
no,
up
no,
to
no,
that?
No, I'm leading up to it. If for instance, one refers to one's mother as in, let's see, where's mother, and you respond, she's in the apple orchard, someone in that family would respond, she is a cow. Your mother is your mother. Hmm. So that actually got ingrained in our little family structure. One does not refer to mother as she. Mother is mother. Hmm. Rachel is Rachel. And because, after all, from a linguistic standpoint, these are impersonal pronouns. They are specific. Their specific design is to depersonalize the reference. And so I get the idea, and I think language evolves, and I think eventually there will be some sort of medium found that doesn't upend linguistic structure.
Right, and ideas just in general evolve, and what we accept and don't accept. I mean, in our lifetime, you know, we've seen it. We were both kids when the feminist wave of the post-1960s and into the early 70s first became very public, you know, with Gloria Steinem and Ms. Magazine and women marching. And you know, Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs, all of those were things that it's startling now if you watch any of that footage on YouTube or you read about it, just how insanely chauvinistic our society was. And we even, I think, the most committed conservatives might look at that and say, God, that was a bit much, to ridicule those people in that way, or the civil rights movement, you know, and some of the things that have gone on with that in terms of public commentary. We've evolved as a whole. I don't know. I lost my train of thought, I guess. But ideas evolve. And what seems unacceptable in the midst of it, over time, you do go like, oh, yeah, it was crazy that we didn't ever accept this.
From time to time on social media, you'll run across, or I've run across, little collections of, and it's sort of clickbaity, ads from a bygone era that would be shocking and horrifying today.
Yeah. The guy spanking his wife because she didn't make the right coffee, and it's presented as a comic thing.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And even for people of our age, Dan, we look at that and go, because it's demeaning. And it's derogatory, and it ain't. And for people who were trying to make a ha-ha, it ain't funny.
Well, let me bring this back to our guest here. Then,
yes.
Instead of staying in the 70s for too long, are there any examples of stuff you see today of a language or social message or advertising, whatever? Is there anything that you see needs to change, or what are things that are still examples of sort of that? What's the modern equivalent of the man spanking his wife because she didn't use the right coffee? Is there anything that you've seen recently that you're like, that is just wrong? Or how?
I mean, of course. I mean, you see things all the time. Again, I think the conversation now is like, you see things that, like, sometimes, like, for the most part, you tend to look at things and say, like, well, that's more subtle. Or oftentimes what you see more is what's lacking in commercials or media, as opposed to like what is there and an issue. But of course, like, you know, you can, you know, I remember seeing like a t-shirt once that was like talking about how like a mom's message to her son's girlfriend, like, my son's money is not yours, or something like that. Like, you can find little things still here and there. Mostly, I think issues we see is just lack of representation or weird nuanced messages that imply what is normal and what is not. But again, you can still walk around the mall and find a million little weird, uncomfortable, or offensive messages. I think it's just less common because capitalism and big industries have now caught on that there is a level of unacceptable that people won't buy their product anymore if they are not, quote-unquote, woke enough. which I don't really like the word woke because I think it oversimplifies movements and conversations, but it is helpful in certain contexts. And I've done some amount of research into the idea of, like, quote-unquote woke capitalism and the idea that, like, industries are now kind of using what I, like, consider positive messages of, like, social activism and stuff to make money. So I think at least industries that I see in the New York, Montreal area, which they would look at their target audience and say, you know, we can't get away with most things that we could have before. And that's all money driven. But of course you can still find things. And I would say, like, a major issue that I see is lack of proper representation. Like, when ads are queer baity and homoerotic with women, but they're not actual queer women represented in ads, or people of color that you see in ads are only light skinned or they're always in the background. So I think the issue of representation is much more in the foreground of our conversations of media and commercials and all of that, but it doesn't mean that those really offensive and fucked up messages aren't still there. I just don't see them as often.
Yeah, and it's still, you know, I've said on the show a couple of times, you know, our skin color, you know, being white, you and me and Phoebe, you know, it's still the default. It's still the one that when there's a script that's going around and they're trying to cast the script, and the young leading lady is introduced as in her mid-20s to, you know, mid to late 20s. She's gorgeous. She's smart. And she's, you know, whatever. It's like right away everybody's trying to get Emma Stone for that part. And Emma Stone is beautiful and she's very talented. But I would imagine it's not so likely that they're then going to Tessa Thompson for that same part. They're looking for Tessa Thompson maybe play the best friend or the competitor or something like that. But the lead in most quote-unquote mainstream movies is still going to be a white person, and more often than not a white man. It's, you know, yes, we've gotten better at including African-Americans and even LGBT characters in not necessarily LGBT-aimed entertainment. You know, it doesn't have to all be boys in the band now. You can happen to have a family next door that's two married people of the same sex, or in a commercial, you can have two people eating Cheerios and it's not, you know, it's not implied. It's very direct that these people are not heterosexual. They're married. You know, they might even say my husband likes Cheerios, you know, and he's a man.
So right. And then the evangelical religion industry puts out a blast, claiming that the culture is going to collapse and loving Jesus is going to cast us all into a lake of eternal fire because a couple of guys on a commercial shared a bite of Cheerios.
Right. But listen, the thing is it's also about the strongest means we have of having an impact on our democratic mm-hmm. society these days is economic impact.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it's, you know, I've gone on some marches and rallies, and I've signed petitions and I've called up congressmen, and the whole time I've done it, I've wondered to myself, how much good does this really do? You know, I can go to an anti, you know, or a gun control rally, and I'm thinking, you know, if the NRA is still going to keep, you know, buying congressmen, or somebody will if the NRA runs out of money. But I do, you know, I saw the thing with Tucker Carlson and how effective that was. And I think that's the way to go. You know, it worked with Martin Luther King. It worked with Gandhi. You know, the power of the boycott. And certainly in America, you know, capitalism is king. And you want to make a change, you know, get people together via the internet and say, we're not going to buy this thing, and let the companies know we're not buying it. And you got to follow through with it. I mean, that's the thing about the preachers you're talking about that say, oh, you know, or Starbucks, you know, they didn't write the name Jesus on Starbucks cups, so we're going to boycott that. And it never seems to amount to a whole lot. I don't think that in fact, you know, calling the so-called boycotting of what are the Kaepernick shoes?
Is that
Nike? You know, there's a whole thing, oh, now that they're bringing Kaepernick back, we're going to boycott Nike. Well, just the opposite happened. Sales shot up because Kaepernick was in those ads.
Yeah, but that's not necessarily a new phenomenon, because throughout most of the 20th century, nothing ever quite sold a book like being labeled banned in Boston.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think, though, in the case of Kaepernick, I think there is, it's like, there is a group of people that will go, yeah, we're going to buy Nikes now, because a bunch of people are saying they won't. Well, we'll fight back. We'll buy a pair of Nikes, you know. Mm-hmm. Again, it worked for Gandhi, you know, with the boycotts there, brought down the British Empire. And Martin Luther King and you know, boycotting, you know, the diners that wouldn't let, you know, black customers.
Well, you know, Phoebe, I'd like to ask, not by way of just idle chatter, but have you, in this year, first year of college, have you already decided what direction you're going to take? You're obviously very well spoken on so far on a very wide variety of topics. Where are your studies taking you?
Can I address the first capitalism thing, and then I'll go into that?
You do whatever you want to. It's a regular radio show.
Great. Yeah, I would say that that's kind of a twofold issue that you just brought up, Dad. I think there's one, the issue of, like, boycotting, which I think is a very I do agree, like, it often is underestimated in the amount of power money has, because money literally means everything in the United States. But I will say, in terms of the opposite, in terms of kind of what I addressed earlier, in terms of woke capitalism, quote unquote, and the Kaepernick Nike ad, is that oftentimes, like, industries are kind of doing the reverse, where if in the case of Nike, yes, they put Kaepernick on there as, like, the face of that commercial, but they also abuse workers and have had other issues. So, and also, to what extent are they just exploiting this, like, active person of color to make money? So I think it's also important to, in any issue of buying and selling in this capitalist market, to be hypercritical of what brand you're buying and selling. And now, kind of going beyond that, I'm a history major with a minor in sociology, and I'm trying to graduate in 3 years. So I'm a first year, but I'm technically considered, like, a second year, or U1, as they call it at McGill, as opposed to U0. But yeah, that's what I'm studying.
Oh, yay for a history major.
Thank you.
If I may interject, too, on Phoebe's behalf, in her senior year of high school, she actually took community college courses here in Rockland County, New York, which I believe all transferred to McGill.
Yeah.
So that also put you ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
And I think it was a great way of using your final year of high school, mm-hmm. rather than just sort of floating through it doing nothing.
Well, I really, Phoebe, like what you said about the so-called woke capitalism. Because in many ways, they are manifested to us through, and this dovetails into what your dad does for a living, through ads, through commercials, which, of course, are nothing more, in most cases, than little itsy-bitsy, teeny-tiny plays. And we see, and we probably see those more than we see actual, what we refer to as content. And so you've got to be aware of things like greenwashing and gender washing, because once you are, and I'm not crazy about the word woke either, but once you are conscious of a predilection to do these things, then you begin to pay attention to them, and you begin to ask questions like, why? Okay, let me throw one out there. In the mornings, I refer to it as my filthy little habit, because there's nothing else on except Fox and Fiends. So more times than not, in the hours between 6 a.m. and 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, I'm over there on MSNBC watching Morning Joe. And their ads run with such predictable regularity that I've almost memorized the script. But I've noticed something. There's a trend, or what looks like a trend in ads, or maybe it's just the venture capital hedge fund that owns all of these companies, and they've got a formula they think that works, and they'll have two white dudes pitching some product that they say they invented together. In the case of what I see most often, it's two white dudes who decided people were paying too much for watches. So they stepped into the market and came up with a watch company that was going to market watches that cost $1.99 to buy in China, because they're made by some 11-year-old chained to a table. And they're going to sell it to you, important demographic, for only $125. But so there's the two bros, and then lo and behold, butted up against that when the next ad will be two bros who decided that contact lenses were too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've moved into a realm, and there's a new series of ads where there's a young bro and an older bro who have decided to inform American men, mind you, men, that it's just too embarrassing to talk about, you know, those kind of problems with your regular doctor, so you can get your Viagra and your Cialis through the mail now with an online app, with an app and an online prescription consultation service. And I can't help but wonder where and how are these decisions made? And why is it always two white bros?
Because a formula. People are so scared. Industries are so scared to break a formula because they know what makes money. It's all, in my opinion, I look at it and I think a lot of it just is a fear of if you break the formula, if you take a risk, then you're not going to get the profit you want. You're going to lose your key audience. And there's such a formula of two white dudes selling you something that has seemed to work, apparently, and seems to make money, that if you break that formula, like, even subconsciously, if these people in the room are looking at it and saying, like, this is what this ad has to look like if we want to get money back, it's just tunnel vision, really.
Well, and also, you know, who is making these ads, or what companies are paying for these ads? They tend to be populated, probably, I would say, the majority with certainly at least mostly white people, and more than likely white dudes. I mean, in the film industry, you know, again, we're making strides. I've seen a lot more, you know, black directors and writers and women of all types. And the Americans, we had one of our writers is a woman who is African-American and is queer. And she's a fantastic writer. She has, a play currently running off-Broadway, doing very well. So, you know, we do have some. It's getting there. But still, the majority of these decisions are being made by white people, and usually more often than not, white men. And so the default for them is, who are we going to have, selling the watches? These two guys are good. Let's get them. You know, they're persuasive. And, you know, you're seeing more, you know, you're seeing families in, like, Target ads that can be mixed race or could be, you know, whatever. It's getting better, you know, but still, and like movies, too. You look at a lot of movies that came out this year that are more diverse, but still a lot of them, like Black Klansman or Sorry to Bother You, which I just watched this week, and it's weird, but it's good.
It's great. It's great. Just crazy.
It's crazy. But those are movies that had to be made on very low budgets. You know, even had some, you know, decent, you know, star types and name actors in it.
Yeah.
You still had to, I know that they had to keep the budgets low. They could only get so much money to make that movie. That's why Black Panther was so significant this year, because it's not just, there's black people in a movie. It's there's black people who are the heroes of the movie in a mainstream, humongous budget movie. It's the biggest Marvel movie yet, I think, unless one of the Avengers, but it's certainly up there. So you'd think that they would get used to the idea that, it doesn't always have to be the default. White people will go see black people in a movie, or men will go see women who are the leads in a movie, if it's a good story and if it's a good movie or a good TV show. That's what you really need. I mean, it was crazy when the Ghostbusters remake came out, a year ago or so, with all women cast. And, you know, it didn't do that great. And people were like, it just shows men aren't going to go, you know, this audience isn't going to go for it. It's like, no, it just goes to show that the movie just wasn't as good as we had all hoped it would be.
Or maybe, because studio execs do make mistakes. And they default toward trying to, because it's capitalism. It's still capitalism. And they default toward making mistakes in favor of things that weren't mistakes earlier. So, hey, let's remake Ghostbusters. Yeah, harumph.
How many times are we going to keep getting a Robin Hood remake? And they keep failing. It's like nobody wants Robin Hood anymore. And you know, but I've never heard anybody say, well, maybe the failure of the latest Robin Hood is because people don't want to see white men as the heroes anymore. They never say that. They certainly said it about Ghostbusters. I think Ocean's 8 did okay.
It also had huge stars. That's true. Like ridiculous stars.
Ridiculous stars. And that was multicultural too. I mean, granted, the leads were still two white women, the main characters, but it was there was certainly a very diverse cast of the mm-hmm. of the eight women, and that was refreshing to see. And look, I wasn't nuts about Crazy Rich Asians. Honestly, I just thought it was a mediocre romantic comedy, but I'm glad it did very, very well.
The funny thing is it was a total dog in actual, no kidding, really Asia.
Yeah, that's what I read. But I certainly have, Asian friends here that are just glad to see themselves on screen doing something besides karate chopping one another.
Well, I would say I did not see Crazy Rich Asians, but based on what I've heard from it, from you guys and friends, I'm kind of getting a similar impression of Love, Simon, where Love, Simon wasn't this, like, amazing movie. It's a cheesy rom-com. But you have a gazillion, bajillion cheesy rom-coms, and they're only making more with straight white people. So it's like, if you have something else, like, why don't, like, queer people deserve a cheesy rom-com? Why don't, like, people of any ethnicity deserve a cheesy rom-com when it's accessible for other people? So I think it's okay that it's not this, like, every movie that features quote-unquote diverse people, aka just normal people, like, has to be this great cinematic thing. It could just be, like, any other movie, and some movies are cheesy rom-coms, and that's awesome, because I didn't grow up being able to go to a movie theater and see, like, queer women having a cheesy rom-com. Like, that just didn't happen. So I'm like, you know what? I don't really care if Love, Simon's that good of a movie. Like, it's still good that it exists. I want to see more of it in different variations.
And look, at my standards are not, they're not certainly better than anybody's. They're different. You know, I mean, I actually just got done watching Seven Samurai, yesterday for the first time.
So, the original?
The original, yeah.
The first time, really?
The first time. Yeah, as big a film snob as I am, there are huge gaps in my cinematic history. But the point is that I'm the kind of person that does go to Canopy and it's like, I haven't seen that Kurosawa or I haven't seen that, I haven't seen Sunset Boulevard in a while. I think I'll watch that. I thoroughly get that there are people who say, you know what? Sometimes you just want a big, stupid romantic comedy, And so what Phoebe said, it's like, yeah, you deserve that. LGBTQ people deserve a big, stupid romantic comedy. So do Asians.
I mean, remember, most of Shakespeare's comedies end with a wedding.
Yeah.
And that's because he was a genius, but he was also very well familiar with the formulaics that worked for his audience. And in a modern context, ending a comedy with a wedding still works. We just have an opportunity to see more and different people getting married.
Mm-hmm.
So, a wacky madcap comedy, and we're still kind of waiting for that. It's like, I don't know if there's such a thing. I'm going to sort of loop back here for a second. I don't know if there's such a thing as a critic of commercials, but I think it's almost become like a low grade hobby of mine. Because I said something a while back, because I just get so interminably tired of the Cialis and the Viagra commercials. Maybe it's a psychological thing. I don't know. But I said, we will know we have reached something approaching reality when the Cialis commercial has two dudes in that bathtub. Because none, I guess the gay community doesn't deal with ED.
Well, even there's usually not a whole lot of African Americans in those, right? Is there maybe one token couple? I guess
I've seen a couple. They're like dancing at a wedding reception or something.
Okay, good. Hey, I think Phoebe actually go ahead. I don't want to speak.
Yeah, I have to head out soon. But thank you so much for having me on your show.
Oh, Phoebe, it was a blast, and anytime. You're welcome here, and your perspectives are, something just gets under your skin or makes you want to hoot like a barn owl. your dad has my contact, and well, you get in touch. I welcome your perspective, and as much or more than anything else, Phoebe, I wish you absolutely all the best in the world as you continue your studies.
Thank you so much.
You're so very, very welcome, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, now you're just stuck with me, I guess. But one of Phoebe's friends wants to go out, so that's part of what Christmas break is
about. Mr. Fisher, can Phoebe come out and play?
No, she has to enlighten the world on her views of gender equality. So no, I'm afraid not.
This is not in any wise condescension. It's not. I'm just proud to hear someone of Phoebe's generation. I don't, I'm pretty sure at the same point in time, there was about as much a chance of me talking about enlightened capitalism as a college freshman as there would be of me talking about, how much I enjoyed Algebra 1.
Yeah, no, I think when we were freshmen, just the revelation that God equals God and dog are spelled backwards, and that maybe we were all living, the universe was all, existing inside the thumbnail of a much larger being, that was about as deep as we got.
Yeah, I am sorry that I didn't get to ask Phoebe how the McGill football team did this year.
I don't think very well, and I don't think they care.
I don't think there is one, is there?
No, there is a football team. Gus, actually, my son Gus. If I may just briefly brag about him, since he's not here to roll his eyes or try to stop me. In his freshman year, Gus actually decided. I don't think they do like halftime shows. Or no, they didn't do a pregame show. So Gus decided that he wanted to get a group of musicians together and perform the McGill football game's pregame show. So he just got like all these – he just put out like via social media and whatever else around the campus, like, hey, you want to just form a big band and play – And they did. And I think they did like original compositions. They just sort of like improvised stuff and put on this show where he was – he was sort of the bass player slash conductor, and they had people playing, everything from violins and electric guitars to various kinds of drums. He does that. He likes to get just groups of people together and create something collectively.
You and your wonderful partner have obviously done a good job raising young, enlightened people, and that's hopeful. That is the essence of hopefulness.
Yeah, and I think that one of the most useful times as a parent is around the dinner table when we are able to get together at the same time at a table. I think from a very early age, your kids are just everything you're talking about over the meatloaf and mashed potatoes is super important into forming what their ideals are and hopefully what they might become. And Helene and I have never strayed from talking politics or talking anything. And we talk a lot of show business, but we'll talk about a book we've read. Or even if we're angry about something, especially in my wife's case, she's never been afraid to say, I'm really pissed about this. And to show kids, hey, it's okay to be pissed about things. We don't always have to pretend everything is good and lovely and we have to accept everything. There's definitely things my kids have absorbed from being around us. There's things that we've definitely tried to focus and teach them, and there are things that they're just born with, any parent can say the same thing where their kids are just born that way, whatever way their children are. You too, there's things about you, I'm sure, that were formed by the time you were six. And for me, the same thing. I knew from the age of six I wanted something to do with movies and storytelling and entertainment because that mattered to me at age six, and it never stopped mattering to me.
Well, what was the old rubric that the essentials of an individual's personality are fully in place by age five? Wasn't that something that was taken as a given some time back.
I guess it depends how you define what essentials are. But yeah, I mean, you know, in my case too, you know, we would go on these long car trips because a lot of my family was in the Pittsburgh area, and we had moved down to Middleburn, West Virginia, which is about 2 hours from Pittsburgh. So every once in a while we drive to grandma's, and that's a 2 hour drive there, and you stay overnight, you drive back the next day or what have you. And just those rides in the car up to grandma's, or my dad and I driving up to Wheeling to go see a movie. I mean, those were really meaningful conversations and meaningful times to me. And certainly not only the showbiz stuff and all that, but a lot of things about my values politically and beyond politics came from just sitting in a car and sort of hashing out the meaning of life and you know, is Jimmy Carter a good president or not a president or whatever? You know, is Richard Pryor the greatest comedian on earth? All of these things, you know, we would have these discussions because you're trapped together in a car, and we didn't have cell phones or built-in televisions or anything else. We had to entertain each other and enlighten one.
Oh, you know, there's a reason I think that you and I became such fast friends so quickly, because my family had something similar, because, as I think I told you, we would come up here. Every time my father got vacation from the furnace.
Uh-huh.
And back then, that was something on the order of a 14-hour drive. And sometimes we'd take it straight through. And the radio really didn't come on because my parents so thoroughly enjoyed talking to each other and talking to me, and sometimes my other siblings when they were in the car as well. I learned most of my family history running back and forth between West Virginia and Alabama. Because there were 14 hours of that most ancient form of, you know, once we rose above the level of hand signals, grunts and squeaks, the earliest human knowledge was passed by memory and speech, not by the written word. It's an Appalachian thing that we talk about our predecessors as if they were just in the room and they'll be back any minute.
Uh-huh.
And so I learned names and behaviors and turns of speech. And the best part of it all is there was always, My family almost provided its own laugh track.
Uh-huh.
Because there was a lot of good humor involved in all of that. And I talk for a living now, and I think part of that is from the fact that I've been just dipped by the heel in scintillating conversation from the time that I began hearing human speech.
Your parents were funny? Your parents both had senses of humor?
Oh, my God.
Uh-huh.
They would sit and read the local newspaper at home, and my father, my father's got his easy chair here, and my mother had her easy chair there, and, you know, she'd be working on a quilt or embroidering something after having worked her ass off to make a dinner and keep the house. The paper would, and they'd share it, they'd share the sections back and forth. But my dad would be reading, and he'd go, and then he'd start laughing, and he'd reach that piece of newspaper, and he'd still be laughing, and he'd reach that section of newspaper across to my mother and just point, because he couldn't stop laughing.
Uh-huh.
And she'd read it, and she'd start laughing, and then they'd pass it to me. And then they would explain to me why it was funny. And they loved things like misplaced modifiers, umpire killed by car crossing the street. You know, the old throw mother from the train a kiss thing.
Got it, right.
And they'd gotten pretty good high school educations in West Virginia, and they were language attuned.
Uh-huh.
And
did
so
go to college?
Neither one of them, no.
Uh-huh.
My father wanted to go and play football at Marshall, and he didn't want to be a pro ball player or anything. He wanted to be a football coach. but the United States Navy had other ideas. And my mother actually got a partial scholarship to go to Davis and Elkins and study journalism. But the I forget the name of the munitions factory on the eastern shore of Maryland that had other ideas.
Is D&E, is that in Martinsburg, West Virginia?
No, that's in that's in Elkins.
Elkins. Oh, Davis and Elkins, right.
Right.
And so... Did what then?
She went to work in a, she and her big sister went to work in a munitions factory on the eastern shore of Maryland. And they made the various shells that were used for that were used to prosecute the war effort.
World War II. Your parents are older than my parents then.
Yeah, my parents were 40 when I was born in 1963.
I see. Yeah, see, my folks, by the time that they had their third child, my sister Kathy, both of my parents were 26 years old, and you got three kids.
Yeah, my parents were decidedly unhip.
Uh-huh.
But they were funny, and you know, they didn't get rock and roll. Dad quit listening to music. The end of my father's music listening ended with the death of Nat King Cole.
Mm. See, that was fun about that was you know, I talked earlier about being in the car, right? And that was one of the fun things about growing up in my family is that my parents were young enough that they were into more or less what was on the pop stations. So we could turn on, you know, wherever we were, you know, there's always a top 40 station. And top 40 in the 1970s was very diverse music. You could have everything from the Beatles to Grand Oak, Arkansas, to Tony Orlando and Don, and the Eagles, whatever. And my folks were pretty much into what was coming on. And I remember, like, my dad bringing home the first Boston album, you know, with that flying guitar thing.
Oh, yeah.
And Fleetwood Mac, Rumors, and Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life. They were, you know, so it was kind of nice to just, you know, we could play stuff that we liked and we didn't have to hear a whole lot of criticism about it. I mean, my folks did not get Kiss at all. And for good reason, they're actually a very crappy band. But when you're in junior high school, Kiss is cool. And you got to have some stuff that your parents hate, you know. And I don't think my folks got the punk rock and new wave stuff a whole lot. I think that's where it started to diverge a bit, when music started getting less sort of melody based and more attitude based. And you know, and I'm not going to try to talk too much on behalf of my parents, because it turns out my mom did listen to our last broadcast, and she was like, "What did you mean when you said that I should try marijuana?" You know, because you and I were talking about the medicinal benefits of marijuana.
Well, wait a minute. Hi, Mrs. Fisher. Welcome.
she'll probably listen to it in the next day or two. But yeah, it still counts. Your welcome still counts. But yeah, when you and I were talking about that, I was like, "Mom, you know, you do have like glaucoma, and sometimes have problems with joints, and you know, physical discomfort. I just think it's something you should try." And you know, I think by the end of our conversation, I mean, I don't know if she's gonna come around to it and buy it on her own. Maybe the next Mother's Day or her birthday, we should, you know, certainly my kids would know how to get it.
One word: edibles.
That's actually what she had said too. Come in, she said, "I don't really want to smoke anything, but you know, maybe tincture or edible, I'll try it." So, I don't partake of the stuff myself, but I do know certainly many people who could help me score for my mom, if need be. You know, my parents were very, and again, I got to watch what I say because I don't want to misrepresent my mother or my father who passed on. But they were different. They stayed married for a long time. They stayed married for 23 years, but they were very different temperamentally. You know, my mom was very much a bookworm. My image of my mother, just if there's one image, it's of her sitting down with a book on her lap. And you could go like look through vacation pictures, and it's like by the pool, there's mom. She's reading a book while the rest of us are in the pool. That's still to this day, she's the most, you know, voracious reader I know. And you know, I have a lot of books on the shelf, but have I read all of them? No, I'll get around to it one of these years, I hope. But my mom really will read everything on her shelf. She, you know, whereas my dad was more like a, you know, neither of my folks originally went to college. And my dad, I think, sort of knew he was smart enough he could have. And there was always a thing where he was trying to sort of prove to himself that he could have. And at the same time, I think he was kind of angry at himself about it, that he didn't go. He didn't have the faith in himself and the confidence that
I think you could say the same thing about my father. He constantly played down his intelligence,
yeah,
and played up my mother's. My mother was a flipping genius.
What my dad had, though, my dad had the gift of gab, and my dad had the ability to go into any room and make friends like that. And it didn't matter who. It could be a room full of dentists, you know, or it could be a room full of drunk, you know, factory workers. Either way, he would be everybody's best buddy by the time he left that room. He just had that magnetism about him, and just very funny. And my mom's funny too, but, you know, in a much more sort of subdued, quiet, dry sense of humor. Whereas my dad was sort of broader and louder, you know. He had this big, not quite like yours, but he had this big, boomy voice. And he was a really nice singer too. He'd go around the house singing Tony Bennett songs. And it was really cool. It was a great family to grow up in, I really have to say.
And of course the power of memory is the power of eternity.
That's right. I know I had plenty of teen angst. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't all up.
No. Yeah. You would have been an alien from another planet if you hadn't. And there are the inevitable conflict arises. And you know, as a parent myself, I've had to step back and I'm sure my lovely wife has as well. And say, you know, this is part of it.
What is your daughter's name?
Well, I've got three of them.
Three of them.
Yeah, Laura, Margie, and Sarah, and then my son is named after me, but his nickname is Ferg.
Okay. Have you had them on the show?
Oh yeah, yeah. Years and years ago, I mean, they pop in from time to time, but years and years ago, for every Christmas Eve, they would come in and read the Christmas story. And it was really cute. You got to hear them sort of grow up over the years. Mm-hmm. But you know, there has to be conflict because I imagine there's some conflict when the mother bird insists on baby bird getting up at the edge of the nest and says, you know, you're going to fly or I'm going to kick your ass out. I think it's endemic to life on Earth.
Well, and just to continue just with my parents' story, too, is that, you know, my mom actually did go back to school eventually, first at New Martinsville Community College. And then she went to WVU for her last year or two and got a degree in education. She was living on campus. And that's when my parents' marriage was kind of coming apart anyway. And they divorced when I was 23 back in, what would it have been, 89. You know, they had a good run. And I don't want to talk too much on their behalf and misrepresent anything. But, you know, and even after the divorce, they always still enjoyed each other. And of course, children bond people. Well, ideally, they bond people no matter what happens in a marriage. That you always have that. But, you know, you have the kids. I can't anticipate myself ever being without my wife. You know, and one of the things that keeps us just, you know, is always something we talk about, is on our mind. Or, you know, what are the kids up to? What are the kids doing? You'll always have that. How old are your kids now?
30. Soon. Oh, wow. Let's see, gotta do the ciphering. 30, soon 25, just turned 23, and soon 22.
Mm. Yeah. So, yeah, my kids are a little behind yours, but they're getting there. Gus is 21 now, and he is going to graduate this year, and he is looking to go into. And I don't mean this to be like home movies. We can get back to politics or culture soon, but he's he is applying to grad school in the New York City area. He wants to study video journalism and documentary film.
Oh.
And he wants to use those skills to help implement social justice and social consciousness and awareness. He'd love to work for a place like Vice or NPR. You know, he did a podcast episode already himself based on science, sort of a science podcast. And he got somebody who a scientist up in his neck of the woods to interview. I forget what form of science, like cognitive science or something like that. And then I hooked him up with Bo Burnham, who's a stand-up comedian who directed the movie I did this year called Eighth Grade, to also do a phone interview. And he did a thing about the science of laughter. You know, why is it physically that we laugh? And what does laughter bring to us?
Oh, what a cool inquiry.
Why do we need to laugh? And yeah, it is cool. And so that's what my kids are doing. I think there's some way or another where whatever Helene has brought into the family and whatever I bring into it, there's a definite fusion of that, where, you know, Helene's family has a tremendous, and you know, Helene is very socially conscious, and don't be surprised if I try to bring her on this sometime also.
Oh, I'd love that.
Yeah. And her mother was a social activist and wound up being an assistant to the New York state senator Al Lowenstein, who was eventually assassinated. They were both Lowenstein and my wife's mother Harriet were very active with Bobby Kennedy's campaigns for both Senate and for the presidency. Unfortunately, you know, which ended when Kennedy was assassinated. So there's history there. You know, we have an original March on Washington poster in our living room that I'm looking at right now. And so but Helene also loves pop culture and movies and books like I do. You know, she's getting her degree, master's degree right now, working on in creative writing. So there's a bit of both. You know, I've always grown up reading newspapers and watching the news on television. And at the same, so it's not like my head is totally into the phony baloney Hollywood stuff. You know, I try to pay attention and listen to podcasts like yours and just keep reading and trying to get a different perspective on everything. So I try to shy away from things like HuffPost and some of the other, you know, left-wing stuff, or too many left-wing links by my Facebook friends, because after a while it's just reinforcing what I already know and believe. And I especially felt that when Hillary lost, because I felt, you know, all along I was so confident and I was so looking forward to what these sites were promising me that I wasn't really paying as much attention to what was going on.
Well, look, I mean, I talk about it quite frequently here. We we suffer from Trump fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
And I welcome these little conversations in part, Dan, because it's a chance to step back from the parade of madness. I mean, we are all, to a certain extent, it feels like over the last 2 years and perhaps for the next couple more, we're all sort of chained to the table at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party.
Right. And you know, as much as I try to be sort of self-deprecating about it and make trivialize it to an extent, I mean, any form of entertainment, popular culture, art that we have, there is importance to it. It's not meaningless. It's not just silly and fun.
But I get real nerdy about things like Aristotle and the idea of catharsis and what happens when you sit down and you share, you have a shared, for lack of a better term, entertainment experience or a shared artistic experience. You know, that in terms of Greek tragedy, the idea of catharsis was a cleansing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you show up at the people don't think, for instance, about the fact that, yes, the Greeks invented the Olympics, but they also had an Olympics of theater.
Mm.
And Sophocles and Euripides and Aristophanes all were winners of the gold at the theatrical version of the Olympics. and it was a means of cultural cohesion, and yes, some lesson teaching, but I'm one of those people who doesn't like horror movies. I just am. But something like Oedipus existed on a plane, probably similar to the way people responded to the first Halloween movies or the first Friday the 13th movies, because it was such a horror that they came away from it. You know, thank the gods that's not me.
Snap your eyes out. What gets more horrifying than that?
Right. You know, with your mother wife's brooch.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty...
mother wife. Come on. Really.
By the way, I just watched recently, Helene is tutoring a student who has to write an essay on Macbeth. So she's been like, she reread Macbeth recently, or the Scottish play, I know.
I was waiting for the Scottish play, yeah.
And she watched a bunch of different versions. And I don't know, have you seen this one, the one with Michael Fassbender and what's her name, Marion Cotillard? It's a very recent adaptation, like 2 years ago. It's fantastic. You can rent it on Amazon.
I want to say I think I did, but I'm not entirely certain.
There's a lot of, you know, there's battle scenes in there that would make Game of Thrones envious. And there's a tremendous amount of period correct detail that's just in the costumes and and they speak with real Scottish accents. They're not doing the...
So they're unintelligible.
They for the most part trod the line. It's intelligible because Michael Fassbender, you know, what can't that guy do? I mean, you know, he's like a living god. But anyway, I highly recommend it. And as one who still has his feet planted in such things, I think you would really enjoy it if you hadn't seen it already.
I'll check it out. I saw a version of it in the last couple of years. I'm not sure if that was it or not. The scene with the so-called three witches,
Weird sisters.
Yeah, the weird sisters. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen before.
Yeah.
But, now, I watched the recent film version of King Lear, and thought that was just magnificent.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely now a trend to bringing Shakespeare to the screen in a form that's neither the stage, you know, basically let's film the stage play, but also I think hopefully they're getting away from the thing of, oh, it's going to be Hamlet, but it's set in the Roaring Twenties, or it's, you know, it's Romeo and Juliet, but they're circus clowns. I think that trend has gone away. At least I hope. But you know, the thing is, what I was saying about how there is an importance to all of this. Even, you know, whether it's a romantic, a silly rom-com, or it's Macbeth, or it's an Avengers movie. These are all reflecting something about us. You know, they're bringing stories that somebody had to think of, and even if you're making a big commercial blockbuster, there has to be something in there that means something to you if you're going to spend all that time and money to make it. And then certainly people respond to that. People are willing to you know, leave their homes and pay, you know, $12 a ticket and get parking and hire a babysitter because they want a story told to them that reflects something that's on their mind. And whether it's escapism or whether, you know, you see Roma, which is on Netflix, and certainly that's not escapist, but it's not all misery either. We need entertainment. We need movies, TV. We need music. You know, we can't live without it. I really think that our lifespans are certainly elongated by the fact that we have music, and that even the worst of us in voice still love to sing along when our song comes on the radio, but in our iPads or even in our heads, just in the shower. I'll think of a song I haven't thought of in 30 years. And I remember the words.
And then you're stuck with it for the next 4 days. Yeah.
I don't mind it. I love earworms. I don't mind it. I mean, unless when I'm depressed or I'm angry about something, I'll sometimes get a depression song in my head. And that's not so good. But if it's a happy, fun song, I don't mind.
I had with the Christmas season passing now, for some reason or another, Judy Garland's "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas" got stuck in my head, and I thought I was going to bawl because you know I wasn't singing it; she was singing it inside my brain.
You know, by the way, that there were different lyrics to that song. I mean, more or less the same, but they did make some changes to that song. When it started becoming like a standard because it was specifically written and recorded for, and I think the original lyrics are on for the movie Meet Me in St. Louis.
Yes.
And in that, I think she talks, instead of, what does it say? We'll have to muddle through somehow. I think it's something deeper and more depressing than that. And God, I wish I had the words in front of me.
Oh, now I'm going to have to look it up after the program. That or the ad hoc horn research department will find it and send it to me in short order.
Yeah, because in Meet Me in St. Louis, Judy Garland has a sister played by, I believe, Margaret O'Brien, and the whole family is going to move from St. Louis. And this was, turn of the century or something like that. It's been a while. But they're going to move from St. Louis, where the World's Fair is going to be, to someplace, to New York City. And everybody's depressed about that. Nobody wants to leave their home. And so she sings this song to her little sister, you know, have yourself, it's, you know what, yeah, things are bad right now. And, you know, and we might not see our family for a whole, you know, our cousins and our grandparents. We're not going to see those people for maybe a year. So we'll have to just muddle through until next year when we will see them. You know we will. It's just not going to be every day. So it's a much sadder song. Than the one you already know.
Well, by the way, I can tell you that folks listening in live are getting a kick out of the conversation. I've had several emails, so you'll be glad to know that. Let me turn our thoughts backwards toward a topic that you mentioned wanted to take in greater detail. The move toward greater diversity in film. One of our dear friends here is our pal Tracy, who refers to herself as the lady cab driver, and we message outside the program from time to time and talk about food porn, and I think it was Christmas Eve or so, I got a message from her saying, "Bob, I'm watching the whitest movie ever made."
Which is what?
White Christmas.
White Christmas, yeah.
And Tracy said, "My God, I don't think there were any black people in America when they made that movie." And then, you know, how it is when you're messaging back and forth. 30 minutes later, my phone goes ding, and she goes, "Hey, a black bartender."
Well, there used to be a time when, you know, there was always a concern of if we have a black character in a movie, if we put, you know, Sidney Poitier in this movie. Is it going to play in the South? Are we going to not make any money from, you know, below the Mason-Dixon line? That was a legitimate business concern of the studios of that time. And it certainly wasn't only Poitier. You know, you go back to Belafonte what's her name? Dorothy Dandridge. There were black stars, but still, I mean, until Poitier, was there ever a real black leading man in a mainstream Hollywood film? I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so. No. And you know, I mentioned Nat King Cole a little bit ago. He was tireless in joining the civil rights struggle, and lo and behold, after everything he went through in the Deep South, he bought himself a house in a nice part of L.A.
Uh-huh.
And was immediately threatened.
Yep.
Castigated, you know, get out of here.
It ain't all below the Mason-Dixon line, folks.
No, not by any stretch of the imagination.
And, you know, it still is. Let's, you know.
Well, let me ask you this from the area in which you work, you know, behind the scenes.
Uh-huh.
I guess, literally behind the scenes, isn't it? Is there an expansion of diversity in that realm?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that, because that's actually something I have written down that I wanted to discuss. The answer is there certainly is a greater diversity. When I got into the business in 1986, and I joined my union in 1994, Christmas of 94. And when I first got in, it was still pretty much like all white, Italian and Irish guys, mostly men, and it was a very macho group of guys. And there were women, but most of the women that worked in my union were prop people or set dressers who were all like daughters or nieces of, longtime members. The idea that you could be a woman without a connection and try to become a prop master was much, much harder. But, time changes everything. As we keep saying, using the word evolves. My union and my industry has evolved. There are now, there are women directors and black writers and people who do what I do, who are openly outwardly gay. And these were things that were unimaginable in 86 or 94, that are not so unimaginable now. And directors of photography, it still has been for so long, the DP was going to be this white dude. And now there are women who are DPs. And, and the thing of even calling somebody a cameraman, we're trying to now say camera person or camera operator.
Operator. What a handy verb.
Yeah, the same way we've gotten used to, firefighter instead of fire.
That's a noun, though. Yeah. Right.
It takes time sometimes for people to get used to it. But, even the most steadfast and stubborn of people will eventually, get tired of being the outlier and conform to the idea that, language or status is going to eventually change. And in my field, there's always been that stereotype too, that women, how much responsibility can women handle? Are they going to get all emotional? What if it's their time of month? Are they going to lose it? And of course that's nonsense. But it took a while for some real heroes out there to be among the first women prop masters. And
there are some real idiosyncrasies in all of this, Dan, because now in the era of costuming, you would see some women, for instance, in the classic era, costumes by Hedda Hopper.
Right. Hedda Hopper was a goth. You're talking about.
Not Hedda Hopper.
Edith Head.
Edith Head. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Hedda Hopper was the gossip columnist.
Yeah. But see, they both have Head in their name.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you worked on the Monkees feature film Head, but that's another story. Bring me the head of Alfonso.
Alfredo.
Alfredo Garcia.
Yes.
But there was a.
So there, I guess there was a little bit of breakthrough there, but what always struck me as fascinating was that the great makeup artists of classic cinema, nobody ever bothered to ask the women's.
Yeah.
It's usually guys.
Well, certainly now it's a woman dominated field, makeup and costumes is still by and large a field for women and gay men. I'm not saying there aren't men in that field, but it's for some reason, or heterosexual men in that field, but it still just attracts that. If there are men, they tend to be gay. But for all I know, I'm talking out of my ass, and there are plenty of heterosexual friends of mine that are going to come up to me and say, "Hey, wait a minute, I'm not gay, and I'm a dresser, I'm a costumer." The big thing to me is DPs, because director of photography, because more often than not, still the gaffer, the grip, those departments are still male dominated.
By the way, let me just interrupt you there for a minute.
Yeah.
For people who don't know, what does a gaffer and a grip and a best boy do?
Okay. well, first of all, you have a DP, director photographer. That's the person who's in charge of working with the director to set up the shot the way the director wants to have it and then light that shot. And if there's camera movement, you know, you have to lay down dolly track or whatever. So you have the gaffer is the head electrician. That person is going to be in charge of setting up the lights and the way the director of photography wants the lights to be set, or how many lights, or what kind of lights, what kind of lenses on the lamp, or what kind of, what, you know, there's different color temperatures of different kinds of lights. And then you have the grip department, and the grips are in charge of many of the mechanical aspects of setting up the shot, both helping the electric department set up the proper light. They'll flag off the light. They'll put these things on stands that will block off portions of the light, so you might get a shadow effect, or put a scrim or a piece of cloth in front of light to give it a softer glow instead of a direct beam. But the grips will also lay out dolly track and be the ones operating the dolly that moves the camera across the dolly track during the shot. There's so many other things that grips do. I don't want to shortchange them. But so there's a key grip. That's the head of the grip department. There's the gaffer, who's the head of the electric department. And then the best boy, and that's something that's
a little gendered, isn't it?
Yeah, and a friend of mine who is an emerging director of photography, who's a woman, I forget what she posted that they would prefer to be called now. And I welcome anybody to contact me anytime to remind me of what that phrase is. But yeah, best boy is the second in command of each of those departments. The best boy electric is the assistant, the next rank below gaffer, and the best boy grip is working next to the key grip. And you know, then you have all these other people. It's really like a military operation. You have a person in charge of a unit. They take the orders from the general and they turn to their troops and say, go over that hill, you know, and that's the hill we're going over. So that's really what it is. And the other departments are a little more simple. You know, I have been
the gaffer is, I've always been fascinated by that word in particular, because in another area of English usage, a gaff is a mistake.
Oh, that's funny. I thought you were going to say the noun version of it, which is a hook. And I think that's how it derives. I think it derives from...
Yeah, you use a gaff from, at sea, you know, you're Hemingway and you brought, you know, the old man's brought in the shark or whatever, and you reach down with a gaff and you haul the fish out of the water.
I think that's how it somehow came about, was somehow related to this idea that a film crew is somehow relatable to a ship's crew or a fishing crew, that you have one person who's in charge of this very specific task, get the fish out of the water or get the lights set the way we want them in the time allotted that we have to do it. That's really something that is very, very important on any film set. It's not just about getting the shot you want and the lighting effect you want and even the performance you want. It's you have an hour and a half to get the shot before we go into lunch penalty, or you know, the producer is threatening to shut us down after the 12th hour. So, you know, how do we as a crew get these things accomplished? And that's where, the military kind of aspect in a way does come in handy, because everybody has to know what his or her job is and just focus on that. And if we each take care of our jobs, then the job as a whole comes together and gets done. And all it takes is one person, whether it's an actor not knowing his or her lines, or the prop master who forgot to bring the key prop for the scene, that can just bring it all down, you know, or maybe the grips set up a rig that somebody doesn't know how to properly do, and in the middle of the shot a light comes falling down. I've seen that happen. There's you know, we're all dependent on one another. I was on Facebook recently, and there's a site for people who are in film crews to post memes and anecdotes and gripes or whatever else. And it got into this stupid argument over which is more important. Like, oh, you know, it was what is more important, the camera or sound? Like, and one of the sayings that...
Well, it's nice to know there are other industries where people get positively juvenile about things. How lovely.
It's like, oh, well, if it weren't for us, it'd be radio, you know. It's like, or, you know, get, hey, you know, it's been almost 100 years, you know, since the jazz singer, you know, get over it. And
that's
you
good.
Know, there is no most. You know, all it takes is one aspect not done properly to bring the whole thing down.
Right, like the old parable of the argument between the stomach, the brain, the heart, and the lungs. Well, you know, if you don't have me, you're not breathing. You brain, heart, stomach, you're all done. Well, you know, if you don't have me, lungs, you ain't getting no blood.
That's right. You don't have to tell this guy about that. And so what was I going to say? I'm vamping for a second because I had a really good thought in my head. Oh, I have spoken to young would-be filmmakers. I've spoken at high school level filmmaker classes and in a few local colleges with some would-be filmmakers. And one of the things I always try to point out to them, and sometimes I see it when they show me their movies, is you cannot underestimate the importance of sound. If you can have a beautiful shot, but if I can't hear the dialogue, or if it just sounds crappy, it's going to take me out. I'm going to get annoyed. And if I'm annoyed, I'm not going to really pay attention to this lovely four minute, you know, uncut dolly shot that you put together, because I'm not going to know what's happening in the story. And I'm just going to be mad that somebody didn't put enough time into the sound mix or cleaning it up properly in post. So we're all important. And it's frustrating for those of us in the crew, too, sometimes, that when we work with a director who doesn't know that much about directing, that they don't know the language of film. They aren't we as people on a shoot, if you've been doing it long enough, we can tell when there are those who know how to compose their shots so that it's going to cut together well, and other people who just go, okay, medium, close-up, close-up, medium, close-up, close-up, you know, where it's just that standard TV style of shooting. And we get disappointed when we're working with directors who clearly don't know or don't aspire toward anything other than mediocrity or worse. Or actors that come to the set not being prepared, not knowing their lines. It's like, wait a minute, you know, we have to take a test to get into our union. And if, you know, if I come to the set without the props, and I can get fired and replaced the next day, you know, just because you're number one on the call sheet or even however many, you know, don't think that you can't be replaced. And it's just not fair that we are putting this effort in and we're paid a fraction of what you are, and we're more professional. We're approaching our crafts with more professionalism than sometimes the people on the call sheets.
Well, let me ask you a question specific to your particular craft. Have you in our previous conversations, you've talked about your film work and your TV work. Mm-hmm. Have you ever done live theater, Broadway, off Broadway, off Broadway? That and
as a crew person professionally, no, not since Theater West Virginia. It's just, you know, honestly, Bob, it's a very, very hard work, and the money is just so crappy. You know, I came to New York City without a lot of money, so right away I was in the mode of I'm going to have to get out there and make X amount of dollars a day if I'm going to stay here. And once I got into a certain field, and once I got in a certain direction, got to know people, I was just going to keep continuing on that path. I didn't take the chance of, well, I'm going to try. And plus Broadway and even off Broadway, that's a different union, same union, different local. It's IOTC local number one in New York's case. So I'm not going to, you know, be able to get into there without really working toward it. I can't just do it on a wire.
Yeah, there are no dispensations from the Pope on that. But
I
trust that props. You know, you shoot, and you move on to the next scene.
Yeah.
Being a properties master in a live show is a considerably different experience, because you've got to repeat it night after night after night after night, right?
Yeah, and I did that in college, and you know, I was in charge of props for I forget which show, I can't even say now, but the shows I did in college, it wasn't so prop dependent. You know, it was about the acting and the dialogue. So it was usually one table. I could put all of the props for whatever show on a table or maybe two tables. And, you know, you do your little, you put paper down and you draw little guidelines, little schematics of where each thing goes. And so that's, you know, if you forgot something, if the hammer wasn't in the spot for the hammer, or the scrolls weren't in the spot for the scrolls. So, but, you know, every scene and every shot in a, you know, and theater is oftentimes more representational than film. Film is much more about, well, if we've got a scene with people who are talking and eating dinner, I've got to have all these, you know, foods that are going to bear scrutiny of a close up, and it has to be fresh and hot for the actors. And what are the forks like? What are the table settings like? What's in the background? You know, all these little details to try to approximate naturalistic life. So it's, and it's however many pages. A script is 120 pages and maybe 60 to 95 or 100 scenes or more. So in each of those, I have to make sure that, you know, if in this scene, this thing happens, I've got to have that thing. And if it plays out over multiple scenes, shot over multiple days, I've got to make sure that I still have it over the multiple days. It's a lot of responsibility. And I just wanted to name check, by the way, three of the best prop masters I've worked with are all women. Diana Burton is probably, I think, one of the most, if not the most, in-demand prop master in New York City these days. Ruth DiPasquale, I've worked with a bunch, and she does. She's one of the most in-demand television prop masters in the business in New York. And then Rachel Weinzimmer was the prop master, is still the prop master for Orange is the New Black, and I've seen her go from being an assistant to being, you know, a top quality, you know, very professional prop master. And it's a joy to see that. And it's a joy to see that the resistance to that is becoming less and less. And there are, you know, there are black prop masters in New York now. And again, it's just to see all of that. It just brings more perspective. Like when I do a movie, when I did Black Swan, it was very important to me to have at least one of my assistants be a woman, because I'm dealing with, you know, an almost all female cast. So I've got to be able to communicate with them. And sometimes the best way is for me not to be the one communicating. It's to have, you know, I had Jasmine sometimes talking with them. I mean, I have to talk with them too, but they can, I also want a woman's perspective. The same when I did Eighth Grade, my assistant on that was a 23-year-old at the time, or 24-year-old named Erica Severson. And Erica was my first and really only choice to be my assistant on that, even though I knew a lot of other people that could have been my assistant. The fact is that Erica is a woman, and Erica is closer to that age of the main character, the 13-year-old girl, than I'll ever be. That was very important, that she could say to me, this is what she would have. You know, it's not enough that she would have a backpack. I wanted Erica's opinion on what was the best backpack for her. And what are the things that aren't in the script that can make the physical objects that can help define the character the main character of Eighth Grade, or of anything? But even if I did a movie where it's all dudes in like prison or something, I still want to have a woman on my crew. Always, I've had people of color on my crew. I want different perspectives because I know what I think, and I know what I come into, my aesthetic, but I want to be told if I'm off base. I want an idea that's better than mine. And I'm only going to get that with people whose experiences are not the same as mine. And I think that makes for better movies, to have writers who come from not just the default white man world, and people who are younger and also old. There's definite age discrimination in my field. Even when I was in like my 40s, I lost out on a. Have I told this anecdote before?
I don't think so.
Okay, I lost out on a job. I did a job interview for a movie in which I was really overqualified for. I mean, And it was a low budget independent movie. And at that point I had done over 25 movies and I didn't get it. And I found out who got the job, and it was somebody who has had like 2 credits and was like 24 years old, 25 years old. And I knew the production manager. So one day when I ran into her, I said, you know, whatever happened with that? I had a great interview, and my resume is my resume. Why did I lose it to that person? And she said, well, the director felt more comfortable with the other person. He really wanted somebody he felt like he could go out and have a beer with. You know, and I think what that really meant is like I intimidated him a bit because of my graying hair at that point. And the fact that I had so much experience, I thought the director was afraid I was going to start to tell him how to direct his movie.
See, you were going to say that it was economic because the guy would work for less.
Well, the union contract says that we all work for the same rate based on the budget of the movie. The only thing that varies in that is kit rental and truck rental if you own a truck. But no, it was really a thing of that person went with somebody that, and for all I know, they did go out for beers together, and I hope it was great beer because that person's movie sucked. I saw it, and I won't name names, but it was a terrible movie.
You can tell me off air.
I don't know. Just let my forgiving nature be what it is and let it go. But it does make for a good anecdote, I think. And people my age, you know, we do get discriminated against because there is a thing of, oh my God, is he going to have a heart attack in the middle of it? Or is he going to get tired?
Is he going to need a heart transplant in the middle of it?
Well, I'm done prop mastering. I'm no longer going to be a department head. It's too stressful. And I'm actually kind of glad about that. Like I'm still going to do props, but when I go back to it in March, hopefully, I'm very happy to be taking orders from another prop master. As long as I'm part of the system and as long as I'm able to have a weekly paycheck, that's good. But I don't need to be the boss to do either one of those. And at the same time, I won't be bringing the problems of the production home with me every night, or certainly I won't be working on weekends because this thing that we didn't need for 6 weeks is suddenly now moved up on the schedule to Monday.
You've got a perfectly lovely new heart beating in your chest. There's no sense in bathing it with all those damn stress hormones.
Right. And I want to do a bit more with my life now that I'm going into the back, however many holes, the back nine, let's say, of my life's golf course. I'd like to do things more than just define my life as being on movie sets. I am working on a novel in progress. I've done 10 out of the 13 chapters. I've got 3 more to go. And then I'll have the first draft of a novel. And whatever happens to it after that will be great. But even if nothing happens, it's like, guess what I did? I wrote a novel. And I'd like to write more than one. And also, and I told you this on one of the other ones, I'd like to travel. I'd like to maybe be one of those couples that goes out on nature trails together and hikes around a bit and you know, explores parts of the United States.
Well, come on back home to West Virginia. We got some trails that'll take your breath away.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I'm going to whitewater raft anytime soon. I don't know.
Well, I don't. I certainly don't.
Here in Rockland County, just 30 miles from New York City, we have fantastic trails and lakes and so forth. And you know, the Palisades are my literal backyard are the Palisades that look out over the Hudson River.
That's beautiful country.
Yeah, my son was just telling me, oh, there's a trail. If you just sneak up behind our house, you go up the woods, you get at the top there, and you can look out over the whole Hudson Valley. And you can walk along, and if you look to the other side, you look down all over Rockland County, and you can go out for like a mile on that trail. So, yeah.
Close are you to doing a mile on a trail?
I don't think I could do that for another 3 months. I'm working up to it. I start physical therapy in January, where I'm going to do treadmill work. So that's something that will work me up to trails and to heavier inclines and stuff like that.
Well, you've had a couple of inquiries here.
Let's get to that.
I'd like to run past you. Steve from Georgistan says, do you think drones will ever take the place of cranes or dolly shots, or is that something that you just can't duplicate?
No, they already have. We do use drones sometimes on films, and drones keep getting better and better. I did a movie a couple years ago that barely got released. It was a Rob Reiner movie with Michael Douglas and Diane Keaton called And So It Goes. And we had a drone. Rob wanted a shot, like a helicopter type shot, that would fly over like this lake, and then you would see the little lakeside house that Michael Douglas lives in. And we had a drone, and it was one of the earlier models, and it was disastrous. They hooked up a camera to it, and the drone went up in the air, and then all of a sudden, everything, you just hear somebody at the drone controls go, uh-oh, and you hear this like, and it was heading right toward us, and we scattered, and it crashed, and it destroyed the drone, and it destroyed, I'm sure, the camera equipment. But I do know now that the drones are being used for those shots. But I think, though, that there are certain – it's just one more tool. I don't think it's going to replace the crane or the dolly, but it will be something you can use.
Yeah, like that that long single-camera shot at the beginning of Orson Welles' Touch of Evil.
Oh, yeah.
You couldn't do that with a drone, could you?
I don't think so. If I remember that, like that, the camera goes into doorways and stuff and sort of goes all over the place, goes into a car and out of a car.
Oh, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, just a couple of years ago, there was a lot of scuttlebutt about, oh, now that CGI is becoming more advanced, it's going to take the place of actors. You're going to have movies starring, you know, Marlon Brando with Brad Pitt, you know, whatever. You're going to have CGI Marlon Brando or with, you know, and CGI Marilyn Monroe. But the thing is that people still respond to people. And, you know, for all of the what the folks at Pixar can do or what they tried to do with Polar Express, there's something about human eyes and the unpredictability of human beings that I believe will always be something we desire to see as viewers. That there's just something still different. There's an otherness we get. Do you remember that movie the Fly, the Jeff Goldblum?
Oh yeah.
Fly?
Help me.
Well, he didn't say help me in that one.
No.
But played Seth Brundle, right? And there's a scene in there where he was experimenting before he tried transporting himself, where he transported a steak from one transporting machine to the other, and he brings it out and he cooks it and he feeds it to Gina Davis. And the first bite, she says, yeah, it tastes like a steak. And she takes another bite. She goes, oh, no, wait a minute. There's something off about this. It tastes synthetic. And I think that's the thing about CGI. It's still as good as it gets and as close as it gets. There's still something synthetic about it. I mean, I know there's a lot of stuff that I watch now that is probably CGI and I have no idea, like a background. Or, you know, we did American Hustle. And we had scenes that took place in New York City in the 1970s, and we did those in what's the town in Massachusetts? We were about an hour or so west of Boston, and we were on this town's streets, and that was supposed to be like 42nd Street or something. And we had period cars and period costumes and period signage. But we couldn't do anything about the fact that, you know, if you look down the street, you're going to be seeing a Wendy's or whatever, or tall buildings that were not period correct. But they wiped all that out with CGI, and they do that with the Americans too. The very final shot of the Americans are the Jennings family looking out over the city of Moscow, the lights of Moscow, and that was all done green screen and CGI. But you couldn't tell that. But there is still something about when, like, Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, is, like, jumping off of a building just as it explodes, and he happens to grab onto something that saves him from being crushed. And there's something that's, you know, that they're defying the laws of physics in so many different ways. And that's the same with actors and the same with shots, even, that there's some things that you just have to have the real thing. You have to have real actors, and you have to have a dolly. an or crane.
Well, you know, it's interesting you would say that because I think it's somewhere at some point in maybe our last conversation I said I had a passing interest in seeing Welcome to Marwen because
yeah.
because I had seen the documentary Marwen Call.
Oh, I hear that's wonderful.
It is, and everything I read about Welcome to Marwen is that it's a dog.
Yeah.
And yep. Robert Zemeckis directed, of course, and it's exactly what you're talking about. They're using CGI to turn Steve Carell into a G.I. Joe.
Which is a great idea. I mean, I think if they had just, maybe if they'd had the script, a better script, I haven't seen it. I read the bad reviews, and honestly, while I was reading the bad reviews, I was thinking of that conversation you and I had. Because it's in a, you know, I didn't know about the documentary. It's certainly a more original idea than, hey, let's reboot, you know, RoboCop or whatever.
But the central critique of the bad reviews that I read were that he had, because he was so dedicated to this CGI process, that he really had sucked all the humanity not only out of the CGI, you know, Barbie dolls and G.I. Joes, but out of the live actors themselves.
Mm. Yeah, that happens. And I've worked with directors like that, too, that are so into the technical stuff. That's what they know. You know, maybe that's their background. But you have to know actors. You have to know story. You know, listen, Woody Allen has gotten tremendous performances out of his actors. But I've been on Woody's sets, and he doesn't really tell them a whole hell of a lot. You know, he might tell them, do that one a little faster. I mean, supposedly the thing with Woody is he won't tell you anything. And the idea is the actors are supposed to then bring whatever they want into it, and which a lot of actors like. They like that freedom, that the director isn't micromanaging them. He's giving them the freedom to do whatever they feel like doing. But if Woody doesn't like it, he's just going to come back and reshoot it 3 months later. That's his method. But the technical aspects, yeah, Zemeckis, he can be, you know, wonderful with that. I mean, he's done a lot of movies. Like, you know, say what you will about Forrest Gump, but by God, they're you have to have a heart of stone or something to not get a little choked up at a few parts of Forrest Gump, or laugh at a couple of parts. There are a lot of very emotionally touching scenes in that movie, or some of the, or even, you know, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. It's a technical tour de force, but there's a wonderful story to it as well. I tried watching the first Fantastic Beasts movie. I couldn't get through it because I love the Harry Potter stories. I love those kids. I love those characters. But watching the Fantastic Beasts movie, I didn't care at all about any of the people on the screen. I was impressed with the CGI beasts, but there was no sense of danger. There were no sense of stakes. And I didn't really I turned it off halfway through.
It takes quite a bit to make you quit on a film.
Really? Truly? Well, it's different on TV. I've only walked out of one movie my entire... Have you ever walked out of a movie in a theater?
Yes.
Okay, I'll tell you mine, and then you can tell me yours. There was I love the movie Sid and Nancy. Did you ever see that about Sid Vicious?
Oh, yes.
Loved that movie when it came out in 86, 87. And so Alex Cox, the director of that movie, who also did Repo Man, which I liked, it's like, oh, you know, he's got a new movie coming out. I can't wait to see it. And that movie was called Straight to Hell. And it starred Joe Strummer and Dennis Hopper and a bunch of punk rocker types. And you could tell all they did was they took the money that they made from Sid and Nancy, and they went down to Mexico, and they said, we're going to make a spaghetti Western, and we're going to improvise the script. And you can tell I'm sure they took a lot of the budget and blew it on drugs. There are scenes you're watching of that movie where it's like, these people are high as balls. And they're having a great time, and I'm sitting here bored. I walked out of Straight to Hell. And that's after, you know, worshiping Alex Cox for Sid and Nancy. So that's the one and only time I've ever walked out. I almost walked out of all things that movie Twins that came out a long time ago with Schwarzenegger.
No. Yeah.
Because it's like, they're not alike, but somehow they're twins. Get it? And the whole movie is that one joke.
Right. You can all. It's one long shoot of a single pitch in an executive's office.
Roger Ebert used to have, I think, a saying where he called. I forget what it was called. But he made this point of like if the process of making the deal to get the stars of the movie and the director of the movie together, if the deal making aspect of that movie is more interesting than the movie, then it's a bad movie. You know, how much time and how much effort it took to get Arnold to sign the contract and then Danny DeVito cast in that. Because I think originally it was going to be Eddie Murphy in the Danny DeVito part. That was going to be even wackier, right?
Oh, that would be zany.
And Eddie Murphy are twins somehow. Get it? Because he's black. And then it became, well, he's short and fat and he's Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, so you can see that sometimes where it's like, just the deal making must have been put more effort in.
Yeah,
than
that's the movie.
Conference. That's the movie. Than the story conferences. How's he gonna get? Oh, I don't know anything. Just use the joke we've always used.
I walked. You may think me a Philistine for this. I walked out of the first Rambo movie.
The first one. The
mm-hmm.
first one.
Yep.
I disagree with you with that. You mean First Blood?
Yes.
With Dennehy?
Yeah. Took a hike.
Okay.
Couldn't stand it. It was driving me crazy. But I think I'm a little.
Well, he gets that monologue. You missed the monologue at the end where he has like a three page monologue and you can't understand half of what he's saying. He's like, they wouldn't let us win. We want to Vietnam. We don't have to be there.
Garble.
Yeah. Yeah. Gibberish,
but I'm. It's hard to run me out of one too. But and this is just because I'm an old crank, I guess. I took a no small amount of grief every now and then. I don't get to go to a lot of movies because it's an 80-mile round trip to the movie theater.
Uh huh.
And what gets booked around here is oftentimes not what I'm going to sit down and watch.
Right.
But I guess it was, what, Christmas last year? When the latest Star Wars movie came out?
Yeah, Last Jedi.
Yeah, and you know, I came out of it praying it was the last Star Wars movie.
Yeah, that's another one, I turned it off. It's not meant for me, I guess. But, you know, if you think of the very first Star Wars, what now is called Episode 4, I mean, they built up the world. They took their time. You had the first thing with a big ship and the Princess Leia, but you have a long period of time where, like, Luke is on that planet and trying to decide what his destiny is, and
it's
all...
well, I mean, it's very in the from the part of from the standpoint of George Lucas, it's very much, you know, he admits it himself. It's very much informed by Joseph Campbell's The Power of Myth.
Uh huh.
And
also. He was adapting a Kurosawa movie, The Hidden Fortress.
Mm-hmm.
But yes,
and
but yeah,
so you know, I mean, and so I came back, and I guess it was a Monday. People could look it up on the archives, and I spent my filibobster that evening just hating that movie. I sat all the way through it, and because I had my wife and my son with me, and so I can't just look over and go, all right, we're out of here.
Right.
Or I'll be in the lobby, you know.
Probably, right.
And so I sat there, and I sat there, and I sat there. And I think my takeaway on it was I wanted somebody to give Kylo Ren a swirly and end the movie because, you know, he didn't have the villain oomph.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, I thought you really could probably save the universe by giving that guy a wedgie.
Huh. I tuned out pretty early on. I was in the hospital and I was watching it on Netflix. And I don't want this to be like two grumpy old men talking about how movies aren't any good.
I don't know.
Anymore.
That sounds like a hell of a podcast.
But I turned it off pretty early just because, like, the very first scene, it's this big action scene, but there's no real point to it. You can really tell that somebody went, okay, the first 20 minutes, we got to, or 15 minutes, we have to have a big action scene. You know, so they come up with this thing that has no real purpose other than so people won't be bored in the first 15 minutes.
Look at the size of our special effects budget.
Yeah. Well, and the guy's like cracking jokes as he's, you know, flying around, you know, it's not for me. But they don't care about me, and that's or they care about me around this time, and they think what I care about is like costume dramas or something. I guess so, but I'll stay home. And there's plenty of stuff I can watch. Let me before I get too cranky on this. And it's a shame Phoebe isn't here. Maybe we'll talk about it some more the next time. But one thing that, you know, way back when I had my first heart surgery in December. And they put in the LVAD pump into my heart. You know, Phoebe was, you know, very shaken up by it. And she, of course, and she's sitting next to me one day in the hospital, at the hospital by my bed. And she says, you know, Daddy, when we get home, you know, is there anything I can do for you? And I thought about it for a minute. I said, I'll tell you what I want from you, honey. I said, you are graduating from high school soon. You know, she was in her senior year. I said, you know, I'm going to be home for a while with not a whole lot to do but rest. I said, for the rest of the time that you're here until you leave for college, I want you and I once a week to watch a classic movie together of my choice. And said, what I'll do is I'll make a list and we'll choose together from that list, but it's going to be something that, you know, I think we should see. So I made a list of movies for her that I thought, first of all, I wasn't going to subject her to stuff that I could tell wouldn't be her style at all. I wasn't going to do like Dirty Harry or something like that. And I tried to keep it things with female protagonists or things like that. So there were things on the list that go in anywhere from the 1940s up until current times. So of the 50 movies that I presented to her, we got through about, I don't know how many there are, but I have the list of what we watched. We watched All About Eve, because I wanted her to know about Betty Davis.
Oh.
And All the President's Men, she actually chose that from the list, because we had just seen that movie, The Paper, with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep.
Right.
And then she said, you mentioned this movie all about All the President's Men. That's about Watergate too, isn't it? I said, yeah. In a lot of ways, it's like the prequel to what the movie you just saw, The Paper. And she really liked that one a lot. But we also saw Cabaret, which she loved. And then Carol, which is a current movie that I was prop master of. Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara having a lesbian relationship in the 1950s. And she really liked that one a lot. Casablanca, because you have to watch Casablanca.
Good for you.
Desperately Seeking Susan, which she really didn't like that much. But it was fun to see New York City in the 1980s. Do the Right Thing, which she loved. Fargo, which we actually watched pretty recently. She didn't get into it as much as I thought she would. And the same with Hair. I love Hair, even though it doesn't really have a plot, but it's just fun to me. And I love musicals. But I did show her Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and she loved that. We saw that the night before she left for going to college, and there's still some scenes in that I can watch on YouTube that will always take me back to that night before she left for college, and just make me cry. There's a movie called Short Term 12 that came out a couple of years ago with Brie Larson before she was Brie Larson, and Rami Malek before he became really big. And it's about these kids who are in a foster home situation, and eventually, you know, they try to get them placed in foster families. But in the meantime, they're in this group home, and it's a really terrific movie that's not half as depressing as I'm making it sound. There's actually a lot of like life affirming stuff and funny stuff, and the acting is just incredible, and it's very naturalistic, and she really liked that. And Thelma and Louise, I showed her. And that was like, she's like 10 minutes before the movie. And she's like, how is this going to end? I'm like, I'm not going to tell you. And when they go off the cliff at the end, she was like yelling like, holy shit. And I was like, told you. It's a real twist or anything. And then we watched Wizard of Oz together, which certainly she's seen a number of times. She was even Dorothy one year for Halloween. But you can't see Wizard of Oz.
Have you ever done the thing with her where you sync up Wizard of Oz and Dark Side of the Moon?
No, didn't do that. didn't do that. I don't think I even did it back in the college days.
That's worth doing. I mean, it really is quite surprising.
I think there's a video on YouTube which does the whole thing. You don't have to do any of the sync up work anymore. It does it for you.
Oh, okay. Okay. I mean,
your listeners know about that, the Dark Side of the Moon thing.
Oh, yeah. That's let me ask you, you by bringing up Thelma and Louise, you brought me to a topic that, and I've got another comment here for you. I mentioned Tracy earlier, and Tracy wrote in. I want to share this with you.
Cool, Tracy.
When you mentioned Thelma and Louise, because this, I'm a political person, and because this is a political show, I immediately thought and spat on the ground, not because of Gina Davis, but because of the outcome of the 2016 elections.
Susan Sarandon.
And the stunningly ignorant, short-sighted, highly annoying crap that emanated from her mouth during that campaign.
Yeah.
Do you, as an appreciator of film, do you ever have difficulty separating the actor from the work based upon the actor's public statements?
In the case of Susan Sarandon, no, I still enjoy her. She's one of my favorite actresses, and I've worked with her a couple of times. I was on the set dressing crew of Dead Man Walking, and I was sometimes on set for what was that firefighter show called with Dennis Leary? Anyway,
Rescue Me.
So I don't know. For some reason, no politics. I don't think so. But the stuff with the sexual harassment stuff, the Me Too stuff, I definitely. I was one of the biggest Louis C.K. fans in the world. I have all of his stuff, in my iPhone, all of his comedy albums. I watched all of his show, Louis. There was even a thing he did called Horace and Pete, which was a self-financed film that I bought from his website. But when that came down, and he admitted to it, I don't need Louis C.K. anymore in my life. And like, the thing of, well, how long does he have to suffer? Well, you know what? How long, you know, the stuff he did to these women traumatized them for life. And also, you know, a lot of these women were not able to pursue their dreams because of what he did to them. And not just the masturbation thing. I mean, it did come out that in order to keep that Louis C.K.'s management did career damage to some of these women who came out and publicly when they told their stories. And at first they weren't believed. It took a long time. The stories were out there for years on Louis C.K. before anybody did a damn thing about it. Same with Harvey Weinstein. Yeah, I don't know. I can't tell you what flipped the channel on that, where it became like, well, that's just...
I adore Shakespeare in Love. I love that film. It's not particularly accurate, but it's delightful. And yeah, to a certain extent, that film is tainted to me because of what was going on behind the scenes with Harvey Weinstein. Everything he touched, he tainted by virtue of the behavior that we found out he was engaging in, and he ain't even on the scene. Now, on the other hand, Gwyneth Paltrow is in that, and she was delightful, and yet I look at her and now I see a woman who sells other women rocks to put in their vaginas.
Yeah. No, I can separate that. I can, because I mean, those women are foolish consumers, and Goop is full of nonsense as far as I'm concerned. But does it do any real physical or psychological harm to people? I don't know about that, you know. And Weinstein is a distributor. I mean, I'm not going to punish Quentin Tarantino or anybody else because of what Harvey Weinstein did. I mean, I don't know. Well, but then again, I mean, you know, they were complicit. I'm sure they knew what was going on. Matt Damon, I'm sure, knew what was going on. But I don't know.
It's a hard call. Like that weird damn video that Kevin Spacey put out the last few days after it was announced that he was being charged with sexual assault.
Well, that thing was so weird that I had to wonder to myself, you know, is he trying now to go for an insane defense? Because it is insane. Is he enough of an actor that he's now trying to, oh God, I'm losing my voice. You might have to wrap this up without me at some point. But I don't know. But I won't see Spacey's stuff either. And but here's one other thing about Louis C.K. I knew Louis C.K. I worked on a movie he directed called Pootie Tang before anybody knew who Louis C.K. was, before I did. And I got to be really close to Louis. And in fact, on my last day, I had to leave Pootie Tang early to go back to Law and Order. And I left originally without saying goodbye to Louis. I just, you know, at the end of the shoot day, it's like, well, I'm going home. And Louis actually tracked me down as I was leaving in my car. And he stopped the car and I rolled down the window and Louis was hurt. He said, "Fish, you didn't say goodbye." And I was like, "Oh, I didn't think that really mattered to you. I'm sorry." You know, and I he said, "Of course it matters to me." And I was really touched by that he was that considerate of the crew and of me, that it meant something to him. And then I worked on American Hustle. I was prop master of that, and I reminded Louis of that, and he remembered that. So I liked Louis as a person. And so it was really disappointing to me when I found out about that stuff. But it's like, you know what? Fuck Louis. You know, he hurt women, and he did it deliberately and knowingly, and he thought he could get away with it. And even when he apologized, if you read that apology, he keeps talking about how he keeps praising himself in the apology, saying, "Well, I, you know, these were people that looked up to me and admired me, and I abused that privilege." It's like, do you have to keep mentioning how admired you are? Can't you just say, I'm a fucked up human being, and I made a mistake, and I hurt people? And Kevin Spacey's apology was even worse, because he did this thing of like, well, if I did it, I'm sorry. I blame the booze, and by the way, I'm out.
Well, and let me and I really don't want you to lose your voice, but I also, God, I love these conversations.
Good.
Just within the context that we're talking now.
If you have emails coming in, I want to answer those before.
Yeah.
Before this moves.
But I want to put a little bow on the Me Too on the Me Too issues. Our buddy Brother Deacon Asa said, "Could you ever see Trump through the NBC reality show clown glasses ever again?" And if I could expand on that just for a moment, Dan, Mark Burnett.
Yeah.
Now this is a guy who helmed a program in which more and more people are now saying was just a horror show of bigotry and racism. You've got this comedian who did a gig in New York at the beginning of this month where he talked about watching Donald Trump snort rails of Adderall, and he wasn't kidding. It wasn't a joke.
Uh-huh.
And Mark Burnett was at the helm of all of that, and women, you know, with their own Me Too stories out of it. And this guy gets promoted to be head of MGM?
Yeah. You know, here's where my inconsistency shows through, because what I just said about Susan Sarandon, and I'm able to, you know, I could watch Thelma Louise and so forth. And yeah, you know, she might have done her share of electoral damage in 2016. She could have had an influence. I haven't watched Survivor since that, and I'm very aware of it, that by clicking on Survivor, I'm putting money in Mark Burnett's pockets. And
I did not go to see Wonder Woman because I knew that by buying a ticket, I was putting money in Steve Mnuchin's pocket.
I had, you know, this could go down a hole, as I like to call it, rabbit hole. I mean, and this could maybe be next time with, you know, for all I know, another family member guesting of, you know, how far do we go? How consistent can we be as consumers of everything, whether it's entertainment or, you know, I use Amazon. I rent movies from Amazon. I try to buy locally, but sometimes I go to, you know, I know I can get it next day and it's what I want. I'll go to Amazon.
I often have no choice but to walk into Walmart, and I hate myself every time I do.
Yeah. So, you know, how do we make our consumer choices and live with ourselves and our convictions, you know? Or are we all just as, you know, are we all really a bunch of hypocrites? And can we forgive ourselves and change ourselves? That's a whole other 3 hours, I'm afraid.
Well, I think it is, and I want you to – I'm going to Tracy's comment here in a second.
Yeah.
But I want you to this isn't me praising me. This is me praising you. I want you to take pride in the fact that you can that you can do this for – I mean, we don't have commercial breaks. I mean, there's nothing. And so you've consistently – held your own and held the attention of a pretty discriminating community of participants, and I don't even like the word listeners, because you know this is a warm medium, and there's a lot more than just listening going on. There's a shitload of thinking that comes with all of this.
I love the emails. I love the interaction coming in. I love questions that neither one of us thought of.
And this is why I adore working live. Because I can't have this, and I get this 5 nights a week, 3 hours a night, the live real time responses and stuff that's never even in my mind. Tracy starts out with, there's an inside joke here. It goes back to the 2016 election. In which I would say things like, I'm not telling anybody how to vote, but I am going to tell you what this, and this fact is. And there are people who are no longer listening to the program who would send me, stop telling us how to vote, Bob.
Uh-huh.
And so stop telling us how to, Bob, has become, it's a running gag like, oh, I don't know, Jack Benny with his violin.
Uh-huh.
So Tracy begins, stop telling me how to look for black people in a movie, Bob.
She's doing that tongue-in-cheek then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's a bit.
I see.
Let Dan know that the black people that I was looking for in White Christmas were the servants, you know, the only characters that black folks were allowed to portray.
That's right.
Hell, I would never be so bold as to even look for a black person to star in a movie back in the day. But Dan's right. Studios had to think about the bottom line. And then this, and you being the classic film buff you are, I think you'll go, ooh. Do you think that scene in The Heat of the Night when Sidney Poitier slapped the shit out of the white man, we all know that scene wasn't going to play down south.
Right.
But when it played in L.A., my mom said the whole audience stood up and cheered.
Well, that was the thing, too, is it, and also there was a, you know, for all of the fear about, oh, this isn't going to play in the South. It's like, wait a minute, you're thinking the South is only white people, you know, if you bring it down to the South, guess what? Black people buy tickets, too. They buy them a lot. They go to the movies a lot. And that's what we've seen, too, with television. Black people watch television. You know, it's really stunning how. You know, you'll have a movie like Thelma and Louise, which made a lot of money, or Silence of the Lambs, which made a lot of money and won Best Picture, and yet every time those movies come out, it's not like, oh, what the public wants to see are movies with women in the lead parts. They might go like, oh, what the public wants to see are knockoffs of Silence of the Lambs, so you'll get like a version with Madeline Stowe or something hunting a serial killer and. You know, Jennifer Jason Leigh hunting a serial killer. It's like, no, you misinterpret. It's not that they want to see, you know, serial killer movies with women. They want to see women do all kinds of things. Or, you know, it's you know, who was the biggest box office star of at least the early 80s was Eddie Murphy. But that didn't mean that suddenly everybody, you know, the gates opened up for everybody. No, it's still like Eddie Murphy and Poitier especially. When we weren't seeing this influx of African American leading men, we were seeing Sidney Poitier playing all the black leading men that there were, and even then, a lot of his leading men, it's like they were the most. And I think in what was the movie called Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, he plays a surgeon. You know, he has to be the most exemplary, you know, credit to his race, quote unquote, around. You know, it took a while. It really took blaxploitation of the 70s to have like black characters who are not perfect and, you know, acceptable to the, you know, white mainstream audience, that they could be rebellious, they could be violent, they could have sex. You know, Sidney Poitier's characters just were very chaste and very sanitized for your protection.
Non-threatening.
Non-threatening, and we still have that now.
Will Smith.
Yeah, yeah.
He can play a lead, but it's probably not going to be a terribly romantic lead, no matter how talented he is.
Yeah, I can't even, you know, I've seen enough Will Smith movies. I can't think of a lot of love scenes he's gotten to have.
That horrible, horrible, horrible reboot of Wild Wild West, kind of close, sort of maybe.
And who was the female in that?
Selma Hayek.
Selma Hayek. Mm. Oh, that's right. Yeah, I did. I worked on the first Men in Black. And
oh God, I gotta have some minute. So episode 4 of The Adventure Continues will include Dan telling Men in Black stories, because
I'm gonna skip this story for now, because I wanna hear more questions.
James in Illinois simply said Pootie Tang was the bomb. As far as the Last Jedi, James said, I like the movie, but I agree. Kylo Ren is a dime store villain. I think you and I are just going to keep covering ground, because we make plans for what we're going to go into, and then the conversation turns into whatever the conversation is.
Listen, I'm disappointed. I mean, I thoroughly understand, but I'm disappointed that Phoebe couldn't stick around longer. And I don't think she planned on leaving early, but, you know, she's here for college, and one of her best friends from high school texted her during our conversation and said, hey, you know, let's get together. And I understand that.
I'm not put off. I don't feel like she bailed on us, Dan.
We could have gone in a lot of interesting paths that way too.
I'd love to get her take. You mentioned All About Eve. I'd love for her to see, there's a couple, and they're you know, serious films, but Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yeah, that was on the list, and
I'm glad, because I was going to ask.
And also, Who's Afraid of Baby Jane was on the list, and we'll get to that sometime. I love that movie too.
And you know, you mentioned how Louis C.K. couldn't respond without, somehow aggrandizing himself. It reminded me of that classic line that comes out of the whole Watergate and out of the text of All the President's Men, the non-apology apology.
Yep. Yeah.
And in the Watergate context, of course, it's the non-denial denial.
Well, this is a handy tip for everybody listening. Whenever you say I'm sorry and you follow it up with the word but, you're heading into non-apology territory. You know, the best thing to do, and this is after 25 years of marriage, when you say you're sorry, just say you're sorry. Don't validate it. Don't explain it. Do not follow it up with the word but.
And if is another no-no.
Yeah, and especially, for God's sake, don't in one way or another say, I'm sorry, but it's actually really your fault. Do not go there ever. I mean, you're going to say it in a different way, yeah, but you know what I'm saying. Don't implicate, you know, you bear some responsibility for this too. I mean, you can have that conversation, but there's a time and a place for that. When you're apologizing, you just humble yourself all to hell and just say, I'm sorry, I screwed up. I'll try really hard not to do it again. I'll try to learn from this. Do not go into but, or, you know, or like, yeah, like Louis C.K., these people admired me and all the great things I've done for them. No, don't go there. Don't praise yourself. And don't go into Kevin Spacey stuff of, if I did it, you know, don't do it. That's O.J.
That's O.J., right.
If I did it. And while we were talking briefly about my daughter, and I guess we've got, you know, we're gonna do the full 3 hours, you and me, tonight. No wonder why I'm
Well, if your voice holds up, I mean, don't feel pressure.
But I recommend to anybody who has teenage children that if they can stand it, I really recommend the film festival idea. Like I tell you what, the next time your kids do that thing, like maybe it's a birthday present, and they're like, "Daddy, I don't know what to get you. You have everything you seem to need." Pull that one on them. Now, I have the sick guy card I played, right?
Right.
So it's, but you don't even have to have the sick card to maybe get your kids to sit down and watch a black and white movie. Maybe it's not every week, but it's like, maybe you can play that card with them. It all depends. I know kids that would rather watch, garbage in a can for 3 straight hours than watch a black and white movie. It's just something about black and white. Just it's old, or even before the year 2000.
You know, it's not black and white is not a tough sell. It's more of a parental thing. It's dad wants me to watch one of his movies.
But yeah, but again, because of the heart thing, especially. You know, that was a thing where I had some leverage and I knew it, where it's like, I can get you to, but Phoebe's always, Phoebe to her, you know, I don't want to make her misrepresent her. she's always been something of a bit of a daddy's girl in that. And she and I would watch like old, she went through a monster movie phase when she was like 9 or 10. And we would watch like Claude Rains in The Invisible Man,
ooh,
Bride of Frankenstein. So I was like, if we're going to watch monsters, let's watch the universal horror monsters. You know, let's watch Bud and Lou get chased around by Frankenstein, you know, and Abbott and Costello and stuff like that. And it was a lot of fun.
Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, she's always had the patience for that. It's funny because Gus might go into filmmaking of a form. He's never had the patience really to sit down and watch a movie.
Have either of them ever seen The Day the Earth Stood Still?
No, not that one.
Klaatu Barada Nikto, man.
It's been at least 20 years since I've seen it, so I should watch it again. But
of those early ones, the one that horrified me the most, and I think it was because of the sort of the banal potential of it, was Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah, you're next.
Yeah, and you know, no, I mean, it, you know, I'm, what, 9, 10 years old, and just casually checking under the bed, make sure there's no goddamn pod under there, right?
I've been on a zombie movie jag. Lean and I have been on a zombie movie jag recently. Just watched recently this Japanese zombie movie called I Am a Hero. It's pretty good, but the one I really loved I saw recently was called Train to Busan, and it's a Korean zombie movie. It's available on Netflix now, by the way, so you could watch it for free. And what it is, it's this man is taking his daughter to visit her mother. The parents are divorced. He's taking her on the bullet train to go visit her mother in the city of Busan. And as they're about to leave, the entire city that they're in at the time, I don't know what city it is offhand, is under zombie attack. It's like this disease infects people and turns them into zombies, like, instantly. And so the whole town, whole city's under attack. They get on the train, they're leaving, but then somebody who's infected gets on the train, and they're stuck on this train with zombie people. And every bite of the zombie turns somebody else into a zombie. So pretty soon it's really thrilling. It's really fantastic filmmaking, and it's really emotional. There's a part at the end where I, honest to God, I'm crying because one of the main characters sacrifices himself, you know, for somebody he loves. And it's a real act of heroism. And we also saw Shaun of the Dead recently, which is very, very good and very funny. And that's also on Netflix. So that's the stuff I'm in. I keep intending to watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I'm too afraid to watch it. I'm too much of a baby.
You see, but that's kind of where I am. I am so suggestible, Dan, that I have to be careful what I watch before I fall asleep.
Uh-huh.
Or the movie will just keep playing while I'm sleeping. Mm-hmm. And I don't need that with an English drawing room drama, let alone a guy chasing people with chainsaws.
Well, what did you see this year, either in a theater or just anywhere, that was like, that was the, you know, one of your favorites of the year? Like, I liked Black Panther a lot, and I don't usually like superhero movies, but I liked Black Panther.
I loved it, and I don't really go in for the comic book movies, but I adored the second Guardians of the Galaxy.
I didn't see the second one. I really liked the first one a lot.
I'm such a Baby Groot fan that it's not even funny. But the whole thing was well put together. Let's see. Like I said, not a lot of time in movie theaters. I was somewhat agnostic about Dunkirk.
Yeah, I just couldn't emotionally get into it. I was admiring it the whole time, and I was impressed by it the whole time, but I wasn't into it the whole time. You know, it was just spectacle to me. It was 2 hours of spectacle, and I think they really tried to get me emotionally involved. I don't know. I liked it. I really like Black Klansman a lot too.
I have not seen that yet.
It's not perfect. Spike's movies are never perfect. There's always flaws in even the best Spike movie, but it's one of his better ones, and it's audacious as hell for this time. And it ends on a montage of real life events that if you haven't been grabbed by then, you'll certainly be glued to the screen in the last 3 minutes before the credits, just the way he uses film.
For me, this was a year of watching a lot of binge watch episodic television.
Uh-huh.
So there was a lot more of that than there were of actual films. It's a little bit frustrating waiting for stuff to come out. And hit, you know, streaming services. So uh-huh. I'll be watching this year's movies next year.
Yeah, that's how we do it a lot of times. I mean, I'm sure in our demographic that's not an uncommon thing. There is some, you know, on Facebook they have that movie challenge thing, you know, where, you know, a lot of times people are, oh God, I really don't want to have to do this for 10 days. But the 10-day movie challenge thing,
yeah.
You know about that?
Yeah, I've seen it on your page.
Right. And I've gotten, you know, I had like, while I was in the hospital, I got challenged and I did it. And you're supposed to nominate people. And I nominated people. And three of my friends who all happen to be real cinephiles took up the challenge. And from that, I've watched some really interesting stuff. I saw The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly for the first time ever. And it was amazing. I'm doing that now. I'm catching up to stuff all my life. I'm like, yeah, I should watch a spaghetti Western. But I don't know. Do I like Westerns?
Have you ever seen, just out of curiosity, because of the setting, it's not a you know, cowboy Western, but you ever seen Bad Day at Black Rock?
No. Is that the Australian movie?
No. It's Spencer Tracy, Ernest Borgnine.
That's maybe Anthony Mann did that one or somebody like that.
And a man shows up in a nowhere town he's looking to deliver something.
Mm-hmm.
And the town the people of the town just get more and more hostile and stressed until you find out what it is that Spencer Tracy already knows.
Mm.
It's Ernest Borgnine was brilliant in it, and Spencer Tracy was just Spencer Tracy.
So you know what I love too is starting in the 50s. You know, a lot of these. You know, like James Stewart, you know, went to World War II. You know, he was a fighter pilot. And supposedly, you know, the films he did when he came back, which started really with It's a Wonderful Life, Stewart started taking on a darker character, certainly in the Hitchcock movies. And then he would do these Westerns where he wasn't always the good guy, or he'd be a very flawed good guy.
Oh, he and Henry Fonda working together.
And Henry Fonda, you know, with Once Upon a Time in the West, which I've yet to see, but I'm getting the picture now that Henry Fonda plays a badass. He plays the bad guy, the villain, and you know, heartless, ruthless killer. And it's just so great that those guys, you know, they evolved their characters to reflect. It goes back to what we're saying. It goes back to reflecting the time that they're in, the 1950s. Things were changing post-World War II and also, you know, look, McCarthyism, and you know, that's where Invasion of the Body Snatchers comes from, is the McCarthy hearings and that thing of conform, conform, conform. No, some people didn't want to, and they found a way of expressing that in art.
Right.
Hey, are there any more email questions?
Well, Tracy did chime in for a minute and say that the phrase that we were both looking for, talking about the sort of roles that Sidney Poitier had to play, was the noble Negro.
Yeah. And even now, you know, there's another term very similar to that called the magical Negro?
Yes.
Yeah, the white protagonist has that black best friend or the black stranger that comes out from nowhere to teach him, you know, that life is worth living after all, or, you know, racism is bad, or something like that. There was a Will Smith movie.
That's a reason that I'm going to sit down and watch Green Book. Because it's already out there that it is, in many ways, it's a movie that you would kind of hope Hollywood had learned how not to make.
Uh-huh.
Because it is it's kind of a white savior movie, only the white savior is an avowed racist. And in the making of the movie, the family of the actual protagonist, the brilliant musician who was touring the South, was completely left out of the loop.
Mm.
And they just, and the people who wrote it and produced it pretty much made up stuff at will.
That's going to happen. I mean, as much as I liked Black Klansman, I mean, when I started afterwards, like going through IMDb and stuff, because I was curious about, you know, how much of this was actually true. It's based on a true story, true person. It's like he added quite a bit he supplemented the story quite a bit with things. You know, there wasn't really a girlfriend at the time who was this and that, and there was a lot of stuff in it that made it a little more palatable to movie audiences. And I get that. And you know, I worked on a movie that had a lot of controversy at the time, Mississippi Burning, which was about you know, the FBI investigating the murder of three civil rights workers in the 1960s, and it really happened. And there was a lot of controversy. Like, do we have to, again, look at this story through the eyes of the white protagonists, where the black people are basically background extras? And this could very well be their story, but we're not telling their story. We're telling it through the eyes of the white people. Is it a great movie? A lot of people thought it was. And, you know, I haven't seen it in a long time myself. I am proud of having worked on it. It's a gorgeous to look at movie. And it brought the story of Goodman, Schwerner, and Chaney to a contemporary audience that would not have even known it happened unless somebody told them it happened. So there is that to it. But do we need the magical Negro? Do we need to see things through the eyes of the white protagonist? Do we need to keep supplementing real stories with Hollywood touches? And we call it Hollywood, but, you know, it could be anywhere, New York. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Do you have any interest in Vice?
Not really, and I don't know why. I mean, maybe I'm getting a little tired of 2-hour impersonations. You know, you put Christian Bale in the makeup and all. I don't know. Why am I not interested? Because I really like The Big Short a lot, and it's the same filmmaker, Adam McKay, who did that, did Vice. And I saw the trailer for it, and you know, it would be interesting to see, what might it have been like on the day that Chaney shot somebody in the face?
Yeah, and that little, you know, that little scene in the trailer with Steve Carell cackling, "You're crazy, man!" It grabs you. But the reason that I'm not particularly taken with it is the fact that Dick Cheney is a real live, still alive, human being who I sincerely believe should at some point have answered for war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Because I still maintain that the war against the innocent people of Iraq was an illegal war by any metric you choose to apply to it that had been previously established. We were not attacked. We chose to attack them, and we chose to attack. And so if there's even a chuckle, and I got a chuckle out of that trailer, I'm thinking, no, I don't want to see this as somehow, or I don't want to see the death of a million innocent Iraqi civilians as a laugh line.
But then again, if we don't, you know what they say about those who choose to ignore history are doomed to repeat it. If we don't keep bringing up Cheney and Bush every once in a while, if we don't go and reexamine Watergate every once in a while, or civil rights, or keep going back and back and back, and movies do that. Movies deliberately take us back to places and times that no longer exist. Will they be forgotten or unexamined? I mean, look, George H.W. Bush is already, you know, sort of his character has been, you know, oh, he was such a nice guy, you know, and all this stuff. And because of Trump, so many, I've heard a lot of people say, you know what, I kind of miss George W. You know, he was an idiot, but he was a benign idiot, which he wasn't. But that's the whole. But, you know, if we don't have these things to remind us every once in a while that, because I don't know, for all I know, the Vice does show Cheney being evil. I haven't read enough about it. I don't know enough about it. I mean, I could just go see it. I am allowed to go to movies, by the way. Now I'm allowed to go to the theater. Yeah.
And maybe that's where we should wrap this up, because we really haven't touched on it. What's your current status? How are you?
Well, I think I told you last time I can drive now, which is cool. I can go. And so far I've like gone to the library, and you know, I've driven to Starbucks and driven to get a slice of pizza. So that's exciting. I mean, if you
didn't tell the cardiologist about the pizza, did you?
No, I'm allowed to have pizza every once in a while. Pizza is actually one of the restaurant foods that I've been able to have since coming home, because it's fully cooked from top to bottom. A slice of pizza is fully cooked and pretty safe in terms of contamination issues. Whereas something with lettuce, even a turkey sandwich, I don't know what's cooked or cleaned properly. That puts me at risk.
How about Chinese food?
Chinese food, I think we can do now. We did Indian food on Christmas Day. It has to be someplace I really trust and you know, I've been to and some of it's just you go with your gut. There are rules and there are hard rules. And there are rules that are not so hard rules. And, you know, even my cardiologist said recently, it's like, look, you know, we have certain rules for you know, certain months of recuperation. In your case, you know, you're so ahead and you're so aware, you're very conscientious, and you know, you can bend rules a little bit, you know, and you've been good about knowing how to bend them so that you're not putting yourself in danger. You can kind of keep going on that way. It's and I don't want to, you know, make it sound like I'm being, you know, negligent of my own health. I'm not. But we can start to loosen up now. I'm 3 months in, and I've got 3 more months to go in that very initial. I'll always be recuperating. I'll always be a heart patient till the day I die. I'll always take meds, and I'll always have to keep track of what I eat and many other factors of my health that maybe not everybody does on a daily basis. I'm going to have to, but that's okay. It's just a matter of habit. Once you
the nights out snorting cocaine till 4 a.m. are over.
Well, not that I ever did it, because I never really did. Let's say it's too late for me to start. I did coke one time, exactly one time in my life, and that's a whole other story.
I tried snorting coke once, and I about drowned. Yes,
I was an asshole, and I didn't like being an asshole.
Well, we can wrap on a neat piece of another piece of trivia here. Ron and Raleigh just wrote in. Speaking of black leading men, Denzel Washington has never. Now this is Denzel Washington we're talking about. Denzel Washington has never had an on-screen kiss.
I guess so. You know, it was funny because there was criticism. What was that movie he did with Julia Roberts? The Pelican Brief?
Yeah.
Is that what it was called?
Yeah.
There was criticism about that. Like, oh, you'd think if you got Julia Roberts together with Denzel Washington, there'd be a romantic subplot because they're the two of the biggest movie stars in the world. But it was brought up by, I think, Ebert again, who said, you know, in the Pelican Brief, like Julia Roberts' boyfriend like dies in a horrible explosion in the first 10 minutes or so of the movie. And then part of the thing is like her trying to solve the mystery of who killed her boyfriend. So it would be really weird and inappropriate for somebody to go from that state of mourning to, hey, this is a hot guy, I think I'll make out with him. So you can kind of excuse that. Although, I mean, there've been plenty of movies where they've done things that stupid because you got to get the obligatory love scene in there. But you know, Denzel, I like Denzel as an actor a lot. He's a great actor and he's a good looking guy and everything. It is funny. I don't know if on In Fences, for example, did he kiss in that? But he doesn't do humor very well. You know, he's always very, very, very serious. And I guess in Training Day, he laughs and he probably smiles as he's doing evil things. But he's not a guy known for his light touch with the comic. He's more of a very intense, serious leading man. That's his thing. So, you know, I haven't seen every movie he's done.
And so we'll wrap on the political. One last thing. I will be. Because I think it was our first conversation, Dan, where you said that you are not as schooled as you would like. And, well, soon something is going to happen, and we're going to I'm going to ask for your help.
Sure.
The AIC Act, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, that I've been considerably involved in, that would end mountaintop removal, will be reintroduced in the House of Representatives sometime soon. And it will be the first time that it's been introduced in a Democratic House.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means it's the first chance we've actually had to really pass it. We've busted our asses for 6 years now. The seventh anniversary of the AIC Act will be coming up in 2019, and it's all to get to this point. So I'll be asking you, as I will be asking everyone who listens to this program, to please find out who your member of the House of Representatives is,
mm-hmm.
and tell them you insist that they sign on to, and whatever bill number it's called, but it will be called the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, the AIC Act, and help bring a bit of relief to this to particularly Southern West Virginia and all of Appalachia that is affected by it.
I'd be very happy to. I do know who my representative is for our district. It's Nita Lowy, who's a kind of legendary, actually.
Oh, I think she may have actually been on the bill in the past. That's good.
And we actually know her. I mean, we've met her. We got a Christmas card from her and her family. So there is the possibility of me being able to be in contact with her. To literal contact to say this is something that's important to me and to our family, you know, based on my heritage and my roots, and to all of us, and you know, wherever you are in the world, of course, this has a global impact, not just a West Virginia impact.
Well, we've got this is one of those things where we're not supported by any of the big greens. There aren't any Michael Bloomberg Sierra Club millions coming our way to support the work. So, you know, we're passing the hat now to raise the money to be able to do the work in D.C. And we are more excited about this than we have been about it. It was exciting enough to get the first bill ever introduced in the Congress that would end it. That was tremendous. But now to have a fighting chance of actually passing it in the House, well, that's going to be huge. And
I could do it now. You know, you at least can get a hold of me through IM on Facebook. Send me, you know, links to stuff. I want to read up a little bit and know some specifics. And then, yeah, whatever I can do to publicly bring awareness and put a little weight on local representatives representatives in the House. Let them know. Got to represent. Got a voice.
And you know, with Phoebe studying history and Gus studying film, and you know, their daddy being a West Virginian, it would probably be good for them to know about this side of what the reality of West Virginia is, and
sure.
In particular. There have been some magnificent documentary films made about mountaintop removal.
Mm.
And Gus might find those particularly interesting.
Again, if you have any links or titles or whatever,
I'll send them along. Send me
stuff. I've got time right now to read and to educate myself, and I'd love to be part of this. And certainly, you've done enough favors for me. I'd love to do a favor for you and for all of the citizens of my home state.
Well, it is no favor to it's not me doing a favor for you. I genuinely have reveled in this opportunity to reconnect with a friend who was dear to me in those long gone days, and I'm learning through this reconnection. I'm reminded of why I enjoyed our conversations and your company so very, very much those years ago.
The time just flies when we talk.
It does. Well, again, Dan's mom, I hope you enjoyed the program. And all of Dan's friends, I hope you enjoyed the program. Dan, I enjoyed the program. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
Cool. And then maybe like a month or so from now, we'll do it again.
Sounds good.
Cool. All right. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks, everybody.
Take care, Dan. Bye now.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. And that is the irrepressible Dan Fisher. Dear friend of mine, of my youth, and what a wellspring of information he is. And I'm looking forward to our next conversation. I really, really am. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And we'll get we'll have Friday on the front porch tomorrow. And wow, we're running fresh out of 2018. I wonder how many show files I will screw up in the first couple of weeks of 2019 by dating them 2018. I'll try not to. Thanks to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in this little program in whatever way you do. Thank you so very much to all of you who keep this program on the air, our subscribers and the folks who contribute through the weeks and during the program. Thank you one and all. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Sparky and Steve in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. If you would like to help out with the coming work to pass the AIC Act, go to CRMW.net and kick in. Or maybe subscribe at $5 a month or something like that. But make sure that you put in the memo for the AIC Act, okay? That would be a tremendous help. And I'll be reposting the Facebook fundraiser on my Facebook page as quick as I have as quick as I remember to do it. How's that? And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.